Linda was saying. Discussion this afternoon on defamation reform. And normally people eat to the end. Linda, you're so popular there. So let me tell you what's happened. We are approaching the opposition parties tomorrow night. To not just for the fact that we are trying to find some consensus around the tax bills, but also because on this program is difficult to finalize by Friday, partly because of the structure. So the proposal, at this stage is that the ANC is proposing that we approach the other parties to say that we will vote on the bill in the House on Wednesday next. The committee will be given more time to engage with the stakeholders who are agreed and try to find some consensus. And we have negotiated with our party, and they will negotiate with other parties for voting on Tuesday morning next week in the committee and Wednesday afternoon in the House. So that is what I can report to you. But obviously, there's going to be negotiations across the party works on that matter. But even if something happens and we vote on the bill this week, they're still going to sit in the House next week because we're going to finish that program. Okay. Anybody want to say anything about the process?
Regarding the process, so we are no longer voting tomorrow, so it's
left.
If next week and
Wednesday. Well, we don't know. If let's say there's no consensus tomorrow morning in the program and work meeting, well, then we might have to do it. So I'm really unable to find.
We're not voting tomorrow in Dean.
Yeah, but what you say, I don't know what happens if the votes don't agree. Then what's going to happen is I think we'll vote tomorrow morning, and then we'll go to the House in the afternoon and take an exception from the meeting. Or the other option I've put to them is to vote, as I told you this morning, the President's question time ends in 2 hours. The bells ring, we close the House, we close the session. Then we reconvene in 10 minutes and do it on Thursday evening, which is what I've suggested to them. The other option is Friday. Friday, thanks to the parties who choose to get elected to come and vote here on behalf of their constituencies, and then when it comes to vote, they run away. They run away from the vote, and then they so on. And then they will tell you, they will tell you, of course, that the reason they do it is because it's the majority party's responsibility to have the necessary numbers to pass their program. Never mind that we agree on what's the content of that program. So this is where we are. An independent person who I think a certain officer finds it like said, even my words, but he said it depends on what we do. But who's pretty bustling as long as alone in a democracy, and we have to live with that. So it's unlikely we'll vote on Friday. It's more likely we'll vote on Thursday. So if we vote this week, otherwise it'll be next week. So Yala, I'm sorry about this. But unfortunately, you can blame other parties for this, not the study group of the ANC. Now, on the latter matter, I'm not allowing any response. But on the substance of what I said, anybody going to say about the process? So we're stuck until we know. But, so each party will. Can I plead with opposition party members who are here to just cooperate because we close to some sort of narrowing of the gap? And let's see where we go. Thank you. Over then to the National Treasury team. We are looking at part two of that chapter. I have other responsibilities related to some of the work I do here as a chair, but I will have to go into the House now and then. So, Sandy or Dicinelli, one of you can chair, I'll go up. You just have to say, one of Dicinelli can chair. Yeah. I know my protocol, particularly more senior in age, okay? Particularly your chair. 59. Of course, 59.
Thank you, Chair. So just to go continue Sorry, Charles, I apologize for my boss. He's punishing me by the when I was a few minutes late. He can be excused.
Who?
I'm not a
fool. All right. We understood your flight,
No, that's fine. So we're going to look at the two comparison of the two governance models, one for the FISCA and one for the Prudential Authority. So, as you said, Clause 59 talks about the governance arrangements for the Financial Sector Conduct Authority. Explain those first, and then perhaps we can talk about how the Prudential Authority differs. So it has an overall governance objective, which is to manage its affairs efficiently, effectively, and all of those sorts of things. And then there is...
Can you say what he was, Brendan, of the correct Bill Clause 16?
Are you dealing with the slide, then?
Yeah, well, slide, I'll talk about
because
the slide.
Because I want to go through the slide.
And you're taking through the slide, yeah. So the slide, I think, highlights the fact that there's an executive committee. Many of the powers reside at the executive committee level. But certain of the powers are given specifically to the commissioner, and we'll go through how those have been divided up between the executive committee and the commissioner. And then just on the slide, Honourable Lisa's dominoes, which is the governance committee. There's basically a risk remuneration and audit committee for the authority. So Clause 60 establishes the executive committee. It says who is on the committee, which is basically the commissioner and the deputy commissioners, and then it gives a set of responsibilities to the executive committee. So subclause 4 says that they generally oversee the management and administration of the authority, and then subclause 64B says that they act for the Financial Sector Conduct Authority in a certain set of matters. And it's quite important to realize that they have certain responsibilities, and then the commissioner has certain other responsibilities. Yeah, so it's 64B. Not 64B, 60. 60, yeah.
60 subsection 4 subsection
B, yeah. So they have responsibilities in terms of being able to authorize the commissioner to sign. They can delegate powers of the authority to the Prudential Authority. I'll come back to that in a moment. They can make standards or join standards and amend them. Then they can adopt the regulatory strategy of the authority. They can adopt the administrative action procedures of the authority. They can appoint any of the subcommittees that they're allowed to appoint, so those that are required or permitted by law to appoint, and direct the subcommittees. They can determine fees. And those are not levies, those are the fees of the authority, so those are like the license fees or when you ask for a photocopy, it's like 10 rand for a photocopy. And then they can make regulatory instruments where, in terms of specific laws, where they are the responsible authority. And then they can do any other matters signed in terms of financial sector laws to the executive committee. We can go through each of these in quite a lot of detail now, I think. Or we because we're going to get to each of those items has a sort of a so for example, making conduct standards, there's a whole chapter on that. So I thought we'd just quickly highlight these things. And then if there are any questions, we can compare them.
Yeah, but anyway, can we just look at this clause quickly? Any comments? No comments.
Yeah.
Can I just ask a quick question?
Yeah.
When you see, like, say you say 64, you say under 6, there can appoint subcommittees, right? Required or permitted by law, and giving directions regarding the conduct
of work of any subcommittee. But are these only subcommittees that are allowed to under the law? And so, can they set up other subcommittees that are administratively or otherwise necessary but are not required for in the law?
Yes, they can. I think that is in Clause 68.
It's
covered out of what the subcommittees are.
Why would you put it here and say they can establish two sets of subcommittees? Why is the one provided for in law, the other in other subcommittees that they feel the need for are consistent with the law?
We can certainly do that.
No, I think this would
be... Yes, Tommy?
Chair, Roman 3000, making determination of fees in terms of the financial sector law. How is it done in other countries? Do they do that? Do you know what the sector or how is it done?
Let's talk a bit more about the fees. They fees for
licenses, right?
Yeah.
Give us examples of what you mean by that. What are other fees? Fees for photocopying, right?
I'm going to conveniently refer to that.
No, you are the only members here. We don't know much from else, maybe in BS or something. We don't know what a financial...
Yes.
I'm not saying what are the fees for. I'm saying what are the fees after consultation.
I'd like to know what the fees are. Two questions are complementary. Because the one relates to the other.
Right?
Where's Frank Jenkins, the mediator?
No, Chair, firstly, there is a section on fee, but I'm going to refer this to the conduct authority, to the FSB, to explain the fees that they levy. The fees are over to Jonathan or Chair.
Thanks, Chair. So at the moment, the fees we levy are, in a sense, like a user-pay fee. So, for instance, let's take an insurance company, for instance. If they apply, make a specific application, like they apply to transfer some of their policies, or if they apply to change their name, if they apply to add a new part of business to their license, there's a range of applications they can make. Then we charge a fee for the time and resources we spend on processing that application. So we believe it's not right that other insurers or other financial companies should pay for the time we spend on specific applications by a financial institution. So we charge them a fee related to a specific application. And to the other question, yes, this is the general norm internationally amongst regulators. They have a general levy to fund their general activities, but then they also charge a fee for specific processing of specific applications as well. Sorry, I forgot to ask that. So what we do is we have to prescribe the fees in terms of what's currently called a board notice, but what in future would be called a standard. So it would be subject to consultation.
Okay. So I'm just checking if something else has this into. So can you ask you to think about this? Yeah, we ask you to think, but then the committee will just decide. So you kind of have a strong reason why you want to put it to other subcommittee, but because then it's straightforward. Let's make sure you know, you can close if you want.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is the process of appointments for the... this is the appointment of the Commissioner and Deputy Commissioners. Minister appoints Commissioner and Deputy Commissioners. We have designed it to be between, as highlighted in the slide, between 2 and 4 Deputy Commissioners. I think Momo highlighted this in our first briefing where he noted this is quite a big shift from the current model of the FSB where we have a strange hybrid of an executive board, which is sort of the legal person, and then there's also an executive officer who has some responsibilities. What we've decided to do is make it much clearer, and you have this sort of 3-2, well, depending on how many different commissioners are appointed, there will be between 3 and 5 commissioners who will sort of form the head of the organization. This is very much modeled on the Securities and Exchanges Commission in the US and the Australian ASIC, the Australian Securities and Investments Commission, and slightly on Financial Conduct Authority in the UK. Most of these regulatory authorities have the sort of executive board which manages them. And so we've gone for that model. And then there's just a process in terms of, this is how the bill becomes so long, is that you have to specify all these things in terms of what happens if the office becomes vacant, the person can't be disqualified, and those are the usual tests of disqualification, so they're insolvent and so forth, and he has to be resident. And clause 7 is quite important, sub 7. There is a sort of a performance management system, so between them and the commissioner, they must agree on performance measures, and then they must manage the level of performance against those measures.
one of the commissioners. In terms of the question on appropriate expertise, I share your concern. Okay, I think it's meaningless the way it stands, okay, frankly. The expertise could be that you know how to be a commissioner or something else, and is that appropriate? And if you look at item 4, a process for the selection of persons for appointment as commissioner or deputy commissioner may be prescribed by regulation. Last, if you recall what I said was, I think we should look at the SARP process for its board members. That we do, because I think, especially on the regulatory side, it's quite difficult the right people are on. And the only way to know that is to formally interview them. And I think that the SARP's got a good process. I'm not sure it helps to go at the other, not extreme, but at the other end, of course, where Parliament gets involved. It becomes very politicized, I believe, in that process. But I think that if you have a process which I think should outline in the Act, and which kind of piggybacks on that SARB, on the SARB Act, because you want to ensure that the persons at least pass the fit and proper test, for example. And when it gets to the expertise, so if you're a commissioner, you probably want to say, if somebody, let's say, has banking skills, that you don't want the second person also to have banking skills. So it's a matter of balancing, okay? Because you'd be looking at market conduct in the banking sector, but perhaps market conduct with pension funds is different, or in the securities market is different. So when these persons are considered for appointment, you want to ensure that there's a commission which actually has quite a broad set of skills, so that it can operate collectively. So certainly I think, you know, we didn't want to delay the bill and deal with every issue, but I think this is an issue which is probably important enough to spell out the process, so when we come back we can look at that. And I think that will help on the appropriate expertise.
Just to say, my experience has been the words like this are less in the law. You can drop the word appropriate with expertise. It still means what you mean by that word. As far as I know, we used to be told before that if there was an issue there, the judge would interpret that. But if you can't spell out what you mean by expertise, yes, so much the better. But there are times in law we just put like, what is fair, for example. So a court decide. Use the word fair and then somebody will say, what is fair? Okay. So, you'll say anything, Frank?
No.
Yeah. Okay. Do
I think this issue of the point of foreign national affairs came up with a discussion with the governor last week. I think she raised the concern that sometimes there's limitations in terms of getting things in. But I think the point was related to the legislation that was proposed to say South Africa is still, and to what extent does government or government institutions neglect South Africans to as opposed to foreign officers. I think there are important points to
right. We enforce 62 on right.
Thank you, Chair. The commissioner's responsibility, and this is where we sort of try to explain exactly what he does. He's responsible for the day-to-day management and administration of the conduct authority, so you can see him as the CEO. He does the day-to-day running of the authority, and he performs the functions that are laid out for him on behalf of, he performs the functions of the authority, but he has to think about what is in 64B. As you recall, 64B explains what executive committee does. Then the executive committee may assign him specific responsibilities, and he must also implement the policies and strategies of the executive committee. His term of office is 5 years, but he can be reappointed once. Obviously he can resign or she can resign and remove from office. I'll explain the removal process in a moment. And then there's a clause to say that the minister must at least give the commissioner 3 months' notice before his term comes to an end.
Right, any questions there? No, let's move on. Oh, sorry, you said.
In 62.2, is there any reason that you use the term they assign specific responsibilities as a person to delegate? Is that just in your bottom language, or is it specific in this part?
It's not a delegation, it's a delegation. Yeah. It's remember, the ones that are committed to act as a collective and making decisions, they can't delegate their responsibilities. They can in some instances, but the big decisions really need to be done collectively. And in fact, the issue is, do we have enough protections to make sure they don't delegate that? At least I'm not sure. Amongst them, they'll have different skills. So as I said, someone might be more focused on banking and would talk to the unit under that deals with banking, perhaps. So they'd be assigned specific functions, like responsibilities, but ultimately decisions should be made collectively, because as I said, we don't want to also create SARS.
Okay,
well,
you love that word.
Right. Then they hold office on terms and conditions writing by minister, and they may not have their terms and conditions reduced during that person's terms of office.
Any questions? Normal?
Thank you. Then there's quite, sorry.
Yeah. What if the particular point is the minister decides that the term of office is long and it needs to be reviewed? If we have that in legislation, that will be an unintended consequence. Because more often than not, your case is being reviewed. Some of it is referred to other institutions. So are we not limiting the legislation when we put that specific or the rights for the minister to take a decision?
That's a good question, and actually I think to some extent the removal of office deals with that, but I think the intent here is actually to protect the person from sort of a random reduction in their terms of employment. It is in many ways to protect the independence of the office.
And really in the financial sector, there's a lot of potential conflicts that arise. And so it gets back to the operational independence that, there's all kinds of pressures and you do want to make sure that there's a real line between the policy function and the operational function. And the person in the job mustn't feel that if they don't make the decisions that minister or someone would like to hear, that they would not be around. That will influence the type of decisions that they take.
Okay. Next
call,
please.
Okay, we move on to removal of office. So we do want to protect the commissioner potentially from the minister, but on the other hand, we also want to ensure that if the commissioner doesn't do his or her job, in this case it would be his job, then the person can be removed from office. And so what we've done is we've put other legislation in terms of prescribing a procedure for the minister to follow to remove the commissioner from office. Essentially, there are a number of tests which are in tab 3. Firstly, if the commissioner is unable to perform the duties of office for health or other reasons, has failed in a material way to achieve level of performance against performance measures, and remember, those are the performance measures that were agreed at the beginning of the term of office. Then if he hasn't done any of the responsibilities of office, including any responsibilities in terms of legislation. So the typical case here would be a lot of the legislation prescribes things that a regulator must do. So it will, for example, say the registrar must do the following. For example, there's a clause here later on that says the authority must give a decision on a license within, I think it's 12 months or something. That's a good test, right? Objective test. And is acted in a way that is inconsistent with continuing to hold office. Then there has to be an independent inquiry, and that is kind of the process that has to be followed to get to that point. So the minister can't randomly to the Ministry Commissioner. Then the same applies but between for the Deputy Commissioner, but in this case, Commissioner may actually institute the process because technically the Deputy Commissioner reports to the Commissioner, and those are very similar provisions. So those are all the same. So I guess 65 just follows the beginning of 65.
But there's also some age that says you have to report to Parliament, right?
Yes, you have to report.
Okay, good.
68, 65, any questions? No. Right. Why do you report to Parliament if we have no say on its appointment? So you think if the Commissioner or Deputy Commissioner is removed, then the Minister will submit the report and findings of the independent inquiry. But we don't appoint the person.
No.
Why are you answering to us? Was it an unusual business? Or does it happen, right? Right, by the way, as far as I know, you can participate anyway, you put your hand up like anybody else. Yeah. So how far is sub 8? If you don't avoid this problem, why should you? We're not saying we shouldn't. I suppose you could. You would. Just give up your rationale before I ask questions. We don't ask questions on that matter. Oh, okay, that's fine.
Go for it.
Momo's version seems to be completely skeptical about Parliament playing any role in the appointment of commissioners and deputy commissioners. That's in the sense of Clause 61. I wonder if you could just run us through the argument. Why are you skeptical of Parliament playing a role in the appointment of commissioners and deputy commissioners? I can't see the argument, but there might well be one.
All right, fine. Momo?
I think, look, you get different models. I mean, if you, and I think Sarekta certainly, it seems to me, just looking as an outsider, needs to decide how does one to make appointments to certain posts. Okay, so if you have judges, you have the JSC. If it's a CASA or the SEBC, I see a particular process coming on. Okay. If you go to the United States, whilst appointments are made, the Senate has to confirm those appointments. So I guess that extra break, the confirmations that the wrong person is not done. But I think as you can see from these processes, let's look at the US, let's not look here, they do become highly politicized when it's done through the parliament because all the parties get together. Now, sometimes the other extreme, of course, is the minister makes all the appointments, and that has its own pros and cons. Okay, I think the issue is how best do we find a way to get persons with the right skill. Okay, unlike I would say that perhaps if it's control of perhaps the media, I think a financial regulator really needs to be able to do their job. I can't see why that needs to be politicized at all, or it's less political. And perhaps whoever's heading, a media company that's owned by the state or something like that, okay? And I think that in South Africa, yes, we don't have a consistent approach in these things. Sometimes we have it, sometimes we don't. So when it gets to the financial sector, I think we're looking at what sort of work for us. I think that we are looking at the staff as a model and how things have been done there, and they seem to have worked, I would submit, quite well. But how can we ensure that it will continue to work quite well? So, yes, do you have a committee of experts? That's what a staff does. It appoints a panel of experts. If there's a job, this applies for the board. And I think when we amended the Sharp Act about 6 years ago, the issue was, should we not extend that? And the model that we developed was, the panel will actually assess all the candidates for fit and proper, and then the names are put to the president. And in that case, if I'm not wrong, I must check if my memory serves me right, but I think the president appoints the members of the board. Am I right? Is the minister? You got your shareholders. Okay, so it now becomes, maybe we're not easy to just say how it works. Because the shareholders.
So in terms of how it operates, the panel is set by the governor. It has to have a retired judge, and it has three members who are nominated by MEDLEC, judge and the other officials and experts are both nominated by the minister. And the panel obtains nominations, all the nominations from both shareholders and the director, and makes a final recommendation to a shareholder, who then votes on the shareholder representative director. But the rest of the board members are appointed by the minister.
Yes. So, if you look at the sub, there's different types of appointments on the board. Now, we're not in that situation where we have shareholders and so on. So I think we are looking at the system that of that panel. We can decide who best should people the panel. But at least to make sure that we get the right set of skills that at least pass the kind of first test. Now, if Parliament wants to start saying you want to confirm those appointments, I don't know if you can say it and how Parliament works. You know, that's for Parliament to decide. The reason why we put the removal to Parliament is you don't want it just to be a quiet affair. At the very least, even though Parliament is not involved necessarily in appointment, but you also want to know if someone is fired right, for the wrong reason. Okay, now, not that this will be 100% certain to bring out those issues. Mm. And I can think of many examples where there are such cases. But at least it acts as a bit of a check and balance.
Fine, fine. This is another theme. Your Parliament, the appointment of the FCA commissioners, bear in mind the sort of things you say. Right. Next thing, please, quickly.
Right. 66 just says that they're allowed to meet. She says 6 years they must meet as often as they need to. They can use protocol facilities. It's remarkable we have rights in the law, but I was told that it's quite important to have this in the law. There's a quorum. The commissioner chairs the meetings. If the commissioner isn't present, the deputy commissioner chairs it. They can invite anybody to attend, including a representative of the Prudential Authority, the bank, or the National Credit Regulator. And they can regulate proceedings as they like, appropriate, such as this. And then it's 2 minutes.
Right.
I don't object in 2 minutes. Anybody does? No. Okay, my example, you don't die, though, right? I think. You don't object in keeping minutes, do you? Let's go on.
Just a minute.
Maybe I want to congratulate you on the 66-1D.
It is new. It is a new clause that we have decided.
I know the view is, you know what, and I don't think I should be allowed to just meet you from there. I will sit here without kicked up. That should be in the previous year. All right, let's go on.
I think there was some problem with the...
No, me too. When I was Minister of Communications, we could not, nobody could plug. I wanted to ask them, there was not a question in Parliament. When there was a previous minister, long, long ago, in the 11th month he was in position, can you tell me what the capital bill was? As compared to before and after that.
Yeah.
Okay, that's a good question to ask. Okay, let's go back.
Thank you. And there was a court case about whether it was legal or not to meet by telecon, and he decided to make it very clear. Decisions, majority, if there's an equality of votes, then the chair gets a casting vote, in addition to a deliberative vote, and they can make decisions
out. It's
very banal. Governance committees are the dominoes. These are established actually by the Director General.
No, look, and I withdraw what I said. I see what you've got here. Let's go from 60. If you have a whole study in governance and can I withdraw my
question? Oh, that's great.
Members will, can I keep this question? You will fight back. If members say something which you don't find is rigorous enough, the only way we can learn and grow is to fight. Let me tell you something. I'll be curious, comrades. You see, I used to chair local government. There was a guy, he knows it very well, in the United States of the joint. If you asked for a command you knew, you would spend 10 minutes saying chairperson with the greatest of respect, and you would ask him. And you should get really angry with him. See? When he met, the next DVD that came, you didn't read the bill. Somebody will just, you then feel it, the unit is going to get irritated. I haven't said anything all day. So they just say something, and the person will say, okay.
But I say, how? You know, so we look at that. Because you would add commas in the wrong places and the CDG would say, okay, fine. You are God, but God is right. So that's not the way it works here, right? If you don't agree with us, at this stage you must explain why. So for example, I made a very stupid point. You could have told me in Bashir's question, why don't you look there and see there's actually a subheading that says government and other subcommittee chairperson, why can't you even see it saying board chairperson? You tackle me like that. I can't see other members. I like to be challenged. So basically, I issued your time. Can you tell your team basically to be a bit like you? Don't work. I was talking nonsense, I apologize for making that point. Okay. Minister, chairperson made a stupid point. How about that? I said, I would like to be challenged, right? Don't work here. I don't mind, actually, there's due to quorum, right? But in subcommittee meetings, they say, don't talk nonsense, right? This guy's face, remember? You know what I'm talking about? Who was a buffalo system, media. Remember? Nice guy, in the environment now, you know.
Chair, I will fight back if comments get moved, because there's one thing that happens later session, if comments is ridiculous.
You could move back,
because there's one comma in the wrong place, turn on in the right place. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. One turn on, one full stop. That is why, Frank, I don't understand how I've been talking to other chairs. How some committees say, okay, politicians are agreed, scholars are agreed. I don't know how it happens. I'm going to raise this to the highest level. But how we must all do the same thing.
So someone
tell I'm bored.
In this
I'm going to finish some things in 5 minutes, sir. This is an earlier discussion. I was going to the house with somebody. Will you take over chair? All time do you want to see this of your time we see what you from the beginning. Your time is chair because we're clearly the chair. I'm leaving in 5 minutes, yeah. No, there's not who doesn't always chair.
If you can't agree, I'm quite happy.
Right, someone independent appoints the governance of subcommittees, these are risk remuneration also, so the director general appoints them, not the minister, because they're not really a ministerial function, there should be some independent, and they're basically very straightforward committees that do risk remuneration audit, and I don't know if we're going to go into gory detail about exactly what they want.
Gory, I like it. Any more to all
right,
carry on.
Right, then, there are duties of the commissioner, deputy commissioner, and other...
That is really one grammatical thing, right?
Yeah.
Frank will help you. Four. That doesn't make sense, but right? Line 3 says, and on the, and terms and conditions, right? So somebody's putting that in the
end. On the, right? And...
Oh, yeah, right. On the, line 3 is...
Yeah, and...
On the, it is.
Yeah, it is.
Right, please have that later. Then I have a question about 5, which is... a subcommittee established in terms of subjects in 1 must be checked by a person who is not a commissioner, a deputy commissioner, or a staff member of the financial sector conduct authority. Now here I got 5. What do I mean by 5? FIGHCS. Who will be 5?
Sorry? Yes.
Oh, I want to ask you, if a subcommittee is not chaired by a commissioner, or a deputy commissioner, or a staff member, who would it be chaired by? And would that not create a conflict?
No, these are external, like your audit committees.
Oh,
and
right.
So
mm-hmm. Right. Can we go on asking?
Yeah.
Can we move on?
That's fine.
Good. Oh, you're not allowed. Only David is allowed to niggle the chairperson, okay? Because David is rude and equilibrium, and we classify even a particular way. You will first get that reputation, then, you know, I just say one little thing. I don't know what comes with this color, right? But it's a very nice color, right? It's simple, clear, and lucid. There are typographical things here. It's beautifully cast, actually. I really think it's a very nice color.
Maybe you should have
it. I don't draft it there. It's a very nice color, right? I would like to draft it this actually.
We have a big team.
I don't know if you'd be up here as an author, but I guess Roy and Kathy.
Very simply done, Sandy. Plain and simple, and it's laid out nicely and so on.
I do the interesting.
Okay, thank you. And then the commissioner, deputy commissioners, and other tribunals, they have duties, they must be honest, they must perform in good faith for purpose. These are very useful tests if we do need to institute a commission of inquiry, obviously. They mustn't improperly benefit themselves or another person, cause detriment. So at this point, I'm going to pause and at September 69 and just go back to the Prudential Authority. Which is a slightly different animal, but many of the things are the same. So I'm just going to highlight where the difference is. Thank you, Chair. Then I think we had done up to... Sorry, I'm not sure what we were... We were at the beginning of part two, so it's the governance. 55, yeah, part two. Okay, same governance objective. So 35 on page 31.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair. The Prudential Authority, same requirements. The appointment, however, of the CEO of the Prudential Authority is slightly different to that of the Conduct Authority. The governor actually initiates the appointment because it is a deputy governor. This is not that straightforward in the sense that the deputy governors are generally already appointed under the process. There's a process of events for this. But the governor essentially appoints one of the deputy governors who has appropriate expertise in the financial sector. But it can't be the deputy governor that's responsible for financial stability as the chief executive officer of the Prudential Authority. When the governor appoints the person, then there's obviously performance measures that have to be used. It's very similar. However, it's important to highlight that the primary relationship there is between the governor and the deputy governor. So that's slightly different. And I think as we explained last time, you can see the governor as the non-executive chair of the Prudential Authority, and the deputy governor is the CEO.
So just on that, it's like a parallel reality that you have. You have the sub for its monetary policy. But you have sub when it comes to financial stability. But when you deal with the Prudential Authority, it's now, as I said, the other side of the twin. And so a lot of the provisions that we went through earlier as well are similar, but then you need to definitely take into account that the SARB operates in a particular way. So the fact that the head of the Prudential Authority is one of the deputy governors means it's not quite as open process as when you choose the head of the commissioners, because the process of choosing a deputy governor determines that is the more open process that you have. And that's determined in terms of the SARB Act. So, and of course, I think Nati did say that the governor would love to come. The point is, a lot of this actually then deals with the internal arrangements of the SARB, and in a way, how it feels this would work within the SARB. So you've got one deputy director for financial stability, deputy governor for Prudential Authority, and that person's the CEO. You've got one who's responsible for financial stability. And the third? It's not really dealt with here, but financial markets. But again, those questions I think you could ask we can just describe what's there now, but obviously talk to the government. But we'll come back to the Prudential Authority in a while. I think we just want to show the similarity of the clauses as you go.
Yeah. Okay, so then instead of an executive committee, so where Financial Conduct Authority had an executive committee, here we have something called the Prudential Committee. It does the same functions. Similarly, the chief executive officer has the same terms of office. The removal process is almost exactly the same, except that the governor initiates the removal process, not the minister, although always with the support of the minister. And then, as I said, there's in clause 41, there is a prudential committee which kind of runs the show, and it has almost very similar functions to the executive committee in the other term.
Yep.
So just to add in, you'll see in looking at those triangles that the triangles between the Prudential Authority and the Conduct Authority don't look exactly the same. And the reason why they don't look the same is because in what Schiller is that in both instances, the full powers and functions vest in each authority, the Prudential Authority and the Conduct Authority. But the way in which those powers and functions are allocated is slightly different. So in the Conduct Authority, the full powers are exercised by the Commission and the Deputy Commissioners, acting on an executive basis. On the Prudential Authority, because of it residing within the Reserve Bank, there's a split between a non-executive and executive role. So what Roy was describing as being the CEO, who's the Deputy Governor, responsible for executing the executive functions of the Prudential Authority, is then that function is separated from the more non-executive functions of the Prudential Committee of the government, which in effect would be the governor and other deputy governor. And the reason why that is to keep some degree of independence between the Prudential Authority and the Reserve Bank.
Okay, any questions?
No? Then everything is basically the same. They can also, if they want, do things by telephone or by fancy audiovisual stuff. Decisions are the same as majority. Then you have committees, subcommittees, and then there's good people. Thank you very much. Then, so we've explained the overall governance structure. Then I think a really exciting thing that we have borrowed from other jurisdictions is both the Prudential Authority and the Conduct Authority must have something called a regulatory strategy. The regulatory strategy basically is a statement by the two authorities of what they're going to do, how they're going to do it, how they're going to make the decisions. Basically, it's sort of a statement to the world about how they're going to function. We already have something similar, but it's not quite as extensive in the PFMA, in the Public Finance Management Act, where you have to have a copy of the strategic plan, but this is sort of a more extensive statement of what you need to do. Australia has something similar, but it's not quite as extensive there. There's something called the Statement of Intent. And other authorities also have these kind of statements of how they're going to function. So in short, Clause 47 requires the Prudential Authority to have a regulatory strategy, and Clause 56 requires one of the 70 requires the Conduct Authority to have a regulatory strategy. They have to have one. So, yeah, let's have questions on that. On that idea.
Just want to point out that how does your regulatory strategy of the Conduct Authority to the public entity in terms of this vehicle, how does that differ from your strategic plan and your government in terms of the vehicle? Because I see both acts also include this.
Thank you. Clearly, Advocate Jenkins is away. And he's asked the same question that I think the FSB asked back in the day. They highlighted the same issue. So the two issues, the first is obviously that the Prudential Authority isn't a PFMA entity, so there isn't a requirement for a strategic plan. So to some extent what we're doing here is we're saying that despite the fact that you're not a PFMA entity, we still want you to have a strategic plan. Then the second issue is that...
Yeah, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fine.
The prudential authority is an organ of state.
Yes, but not
a... Well, it doesn't have a district personality.
Yeah.
In other words, it can't be sued.
No, the prudential authority is actually a juristic person. The second clause of the first strata press, 32 sub 2.
Okay,
so
it's not a public
entity. So it's not a
public
entity,
So
for that
one, so it has a requirement
in terms of this legislation. Yes. For us, that's a type of strategic plan. Yes. That
the
conduct
authority is a public entity.
Yes.
So it must have a strategic plan.
Yes.
In fact, it must have
put
those plans. It could be fit within the...
Correct.
Ministry of Finance.
Yeah,
same
ministry. Different part of
the
Treasury.
I'm looking at from Parliament.
Yes.
So we look at the strategic plans and do the budget.
Yes.
So we unpack all those. It's certain that we do TCIA. So we will look at that strategic plan, and which one are we going to be looking at? Are there
exercises? So we have quite a little sub-clause, 70 sub 6, which says that if a minister agrees, the two can be combined.
Yeah,
it's a very good question because we don't want to over-report. Sorry, Chair, yes?
It's a clause,
yes.
So the clause is for 32.2.
Yeah, 32.2.
And Chair, I mean, you know, this is why, I mean, this is sort of a juristic person within the South. And it also confused us initially about how it would work. So it's actually something that's worth, I think, talking about, particularly, I guess, when the governor is here, because it does get into issues of how, you know, the governor organizes the sub, and we didn't want to certainly in this, you know, tell the sub how to be organized. But there are some issues of public interest, so.
Just to add to Chair, so what the UK did is initially when they set up their prudential authority inside the central bank, they made it a full subsidiary of the Bank of England. It has its own board of directors, etc., etc. In our meetings with them, they highlighted that that was a very inefficient approach and cost a lot of money. And they actually have now got an amendment bill in Parliament to actually combine the two closer to each other. We've actually followed the kind of updated Bank of England approach. But these are things I think...
So they followed us.
They followed us. We had ours first. You're
yeah.
Right.
She had ours first. I mean, and yeah. That's actually quite a good question, sorry, for when you do go to the UK, because they obviously try to... Look, and in the UK, they also have some interesting ways of trying to get coordination. So they would make also... There's a deputy governor responsible also for stability, financial stability, and one also for the prudential authority. There's an issue of whether the CEO should be a deputy governor or not. That's also, I guess, a question that one could ask, right? Within the staff, that's the way they arrange it. But in the Bank of England, the governor is also then on the board of the Financial Conduct Authority. And the CEO of the Financial Conduct Authority is also on the board of the Prudential Authority. But now they're getting rid of the board. So I don't know what the new arrangement is, okay? So both have to take each other seriously because they're on each other's boards and they could certainly raise issues. As I said, we've not thought that the board approach really works with regulators. It really is very problematic, for different reasons, okay, which we can talk about as well at some point. And it seems that in the Bank of England they've come to the same sort of realization. And in fact, the Bank of England has, I mean, called its board, and they've got, it's a few hundred years old, so it could be called the court or something. And Unati, what do they call it? The board of the Bank of England. It's called Court of Governors, or it's got some really, you know, interesting names, okay? But it is just a, it is a board. But anyway, so you know, you'll see some of that. Certainly there's a comparison with the UK. Because I promise you the list of applicants will be long. Okay. So, and like Edward Jenkins says, the PFNA does derive from Chapter 13 of the Constitution, the Treasury norms and standards. Now, but of course, the SARB itself is excluded because it's also a constitutional institution. But we didn't want to then therefore say, because it's mentioned that all constitutional institutions should also be exempt from the PFNA. So I'm saying there's a set of issues there. But the SARB, I think there were good reasons, just given its operations and so on, that we were quite clear the PFMA shouldn't apply to it. And of course, you have the SARB Act, which is quite strict. Now, once you get to this authority, the issue in the PFMA, the way I understand it, is that yes, if it's a state-owned entity, or what we call, I think, Schedule 3 entities, which are the big entities, that you do need like a full board and so on. Then you have what are called government business entities and government and just non-business entities. And I've forgotten, but you've got two categories, A and B and C and D. And of course, in those, many times, we don't want the full as if they need to have king-free board and so on. So again, where does this fit in? So I think it's an important issue, theme that we do need to look at, and we're not looking for an exception. But certainly the regulatory strategy, I would have argued it perhaps slightly differently. Not really a strat plan, it's just how you regulate. It will affect your strat plan, sure, about how the nitty-gritty of how many people you have, etc. In fact, I was reading an interesting article yesterday where the British Bankers Association has done a study which was conducted by Sir Hector Sanchez, who was the CEO of the Financial Services Authority. And their recommendation is all these authorities should have a joint regulatory strategy, which is something that you could also think about. So you can even see there's a lot of debate, even amongst ourselves. You know, we aren't actually regulators. Those guys are regulating, so they say we talk nonsense, but we've got ideas as well.
I think it's an interesting one. Just a couple of other points on the regulatory strategy specifically and on the PFMA. I think the intent has never been to replace the PFMA. It's to sometimes take additional high standards and make it more clear as to what we expect out of some of the PFMA deliverables. So that talks to when we're talking about the regulatory strategy, and I think as Moma has alluded to, we think we're looking at something which is not just a governance requirement from a government perspective, but this is actually something that is much more accessible from a public government perspective as well. So it's seen on narrow or take on elements of what the PFMA will do and describe it more closely, given that the PFMA is something of general application. What this regulatory strategy does is take some of those elements and more closely align to the powers and functions as defined in terms of this act. So also to ensure that some of the deliverables in terms of the PFMA are harnessed or accessed better in terms of the status of the past. Going on to the point about the joint strategy, also what we do here is keeping in mind that it's not just one regulator, it's actually one regulator operating collectively with other regulators, being at least the conduct authority, the financial authority, the Reserve Bank, and the credit regulator. If we do provide for more coordination and cohesion across the regulatory strategy of those organizations.
Yes, let me ask this question. I want everybody else to be interested in. Are you trying to show the bar higher than you came on? I'm putting it in. I know there's an answer to this.
I think what we are trying to is, from a practical experience, deliver on a basic brief. And we've taken from learnings internationally, and we think that this is the regulatory strategy is it's a good tool to keep us all on it.
Thanks, Chair. So the rest is, we can look at the regulatory tools in a bit more detail, but it essentially look at 70 sub 2. There's priorities for the next 2 years, the outcomes of the strategy, how they must perform their regulatory supervisory functions, so. I don't think we're going to every word here, but this really tries to give a framework for what the regulatory strategy should contain. And then, like I say, both the prudential authority and the conduct authority is required to have them. I think it's probably a very straight point to it. You want to just go on to the next one?
The chair.
Strategy, the chief executive officer must publish the strategy in each of the what is that? The operative word is publish.
Hmm.
What practically does that mean?
Ooh, we have a definition, I hope. We had a definition at some stage. Oh, we have to mention it. A previous draft of the actually had a definition, Chair, of the word publish, and of all the drafting sessions I've had, it was more interesting and more complicated because the word publish does not mean what it used to mean. It used to mean you send the thing to the printer and it comes back. Nowadays it doesn't. Essentially what we mean is that we put it on the website. We didn't have a provision in terms of, there is something that's debatable in terms of what we meant by publish, but it basically means make available publicly. There is a huge process, I think Edward Jenkins has helped me here, on the Interpretation Act and where we're going as a government for moving away from publish used to mean it has to be in the government cadet, which means that each thing that we ever do, so we currently are in the process of publishing new banking regulations, and that's 1,200 pages worth of banking regulations that's going to come today. So we are hoping that we can move to electronically.
We're also hoping that, and I think they are in the process of the Department of Gazette Justice.
Yeah.
Sort of doing e-gazettes and so on. Because some of our gazettes cost us over R1 million just to publish it in a gazette. It's not like everyone in the street is dying to have a copy of it.
Yeah. We have to introduce a new innovation which we'll get to. It's a bit of a little bit. The back of the book is quite important. It is, we're creating this new thing called a register, which is a, people are laughing because it has been quite contentious amongst Ahu, to create a register which is a essentially publicly available place, preferably electronic. We hope, currently it can't replace the government gazette, but it's sort of a government gazette for financial services. So, 277 at the back.
Only a controversy because I would say to Roy, you don't have to let me say stuff.
Yes,
it's done.
Okay.
Anyway.
Clause 277 clarifies that,
yes, there it is.
There's a requirement in terms of this act that the other financial sector bodies to publish a document of information, including a requirement to publish in the Gazette. Must be read, that you must also publish it on the register that will be established, and it can also be published on the website of the person or the regulatory authority that is publishing, and any other way that might determine it to be effective to bring it to the attention of the public or the people who need attention to the public. So that part is important.
Yes. Yeah, I think the rest of the clauses are kind of standard, okay? Except that if you look at 71, as I said, there's some things you can delegate. Now, you'd find that there's standard clauses in most legislation, but there are things that you can't delegate. So, for example, the committee of commissioners can't, for example, delegate the power to issue standards. Because you've got to go to clause 60. And maybe you can expand on it. But
no,
I just for the sake of time,
yeah.
I think the rest of it is like, it's almost like you take from what's already there in other legislation in terms of disclosure of interest, the fact that you can have staff and resources. I even wonder why we need some of these clauses. Okay, what's the duties of staff members? But the lawyers say you need those things. And, of course, submission of info. And if you look at the equivalent for the SARB course, there's differences because so you get to this issue of what can be delegated and what can't in clause 48. But as you go further, you know, it has the same disclosure of interest. And then, of course, it's a bit more interesting on staff and resources, because the resources are provided by the staff, so that's in section 51. Again, they've got something on duties, and because there's no PFNA that applies, you've got to sort of put out the financial management duties of the governor, of the deputy governor who is the CEO, including submitting annual report and financial statements. So we want that entity to be able to report as well. But is there anything more to say on those? The clauses are pretty standard in those, but of course who you report to and so on may not be as standard, so it gives you the accountability chain and to whom you're reporting, I guess.
Any
questions for me? Okay. Cool. Get
to slide to another. Okay, we're now going to chapter 5. I'll ask Kathy to walk up to
start with this slide.
Oh, yeah. That's fine. You're so cool.
My apologies, Chair. Yes, Digital Cooperation Coordinator. So chapter 5 is exactly that, and given that, as we've spoken about extensively, the financial system is broad and wide, and there are a number of regulators, financial sector regulators responsible, and even though we are streamlining those, but in addition to which there are also other organ states who impact on our the financial system. And there are various functions that need to be coordinated or well coordinated within the regulatory mandate which has been described. So what this slide is doing is it highlights exactly that. And what it does is it creates various bodies to ensure that what you support the effective coordination amongst these various responsibilities. So the Financial System Council of Regulators brings together all the regulators that are in effect impacting the financial institutions, and we'll talk more about that when we go through the clauses. The Financial Stability Oversight Committee, we've already covered earlier in the stability clauses, and that deals specifically with the stability mandate and is chaired by the Governor. Then specifically with the issues of, just to clarify that the Financial System Council is regulated is much wider, given over the wide number or range of impacted entities and persons. The Interministerial Council, the Financial Interministerial Council, has been proposed in order to deal specifically with coordination at a ministerial level, especially between the, in effect, the ministers responsible for the Prudential Authority and the Conduct Authority, which is the Minister of Finance, and the ministers responsible for the Council Medical Scheme, being the Department of Health, and the ministry responsible for consumer credit, which is currently, or which is the Department of Trade, which is the Minister of Trade and Industry. I think from the Contingency Forum, Roy has already spoken about that, so we are not going to go into detail there. These bodies are more the platform of discussion, but most strongly we have created a kind of elaborate MOU system to ensure support between the various agencies. Also to keep in mind that it's not just the MOU, that right up front, and this would have been covered already, there are strict obligations and duties imposed on each of the regulators to be coordinating with each other and supporting each other's regulatory functions. And so that was what's referenced here is 476, but what I'm referring to is even taking you back to function clauses of the Prudential Authority and the Conduct Authority, which in terms of their functions expressly require the regulators to be supporting one another and just other regulators as well, like the Constitution. Right.
So moving through the clauses in, we start with part one, section 76. This is the clause which fundamentally requires the co-recognition of each other's functions when exercising its own functions. So the financial sector regulator and the Reserve Bank must cooperate, keeping in mind that financial sector regulators in this instance is referring to the Prudential Authority, the College Authority and the Credit Regulator, must cooperate and collaborate when performing their functions in terms of financial sector laws, Credit Act and the Financial Intelligence Centre Act. Also keeping in mind, just to highlight or remind, that financial sector laws in terms of this law does not include the Credit Act, which is why it's specifically named there. And then subclauses, so 76.1A through D, gives greater... So 76.1A through D then gives greater articulation to what it means to cooperate and collaborate, and here we're talking about general assistance, informing about each other about sharing information, matters of common interest, consistent regulatory strategies, just those that we were talking earlier about the harmonization building on pre-agreement requirements, coordinate action in terms or action that may be taken in terms of financial sector laws, and again going more specifically standards licensing supervised on-site inspections. I think what we're intending here, as you'll see reading through here, although E, minimizing duplication of effort and expense, is recognizing that the boundaries between these various regulators are blurred. Even if the functions or the objectives are not, that we need to create flexibility to, that we must create flexibility and the obligation to coordinate their activity to the extent possible, not only to minimize the potential for contradiction, but also to minimize the extent to which the actions of one regulator might impede upon the delivery or the successful execution of another's mandate. And that's on side of the regulators, but from the side of financial institutions, it's also important that we increasingly look to streamline regulatory supervisory oversight and the financial clients
through. It's very easy to say as a matter of principle, but when it comes to actually planning, who's planning this? Because you've got three bodies at this year. There's no plan to convince the meeting, how many times the meetings are convinced, and the other methods that are going to be. Actually, especially on the regulation, it's not the presidential authority. That's why it's more clearer. But where you need to put a set of regulation, given the fact that you need to deal with mathematical conduct, as and when the issue arrives in that segment, who's going to say, okay, fine.
From understanding correctly, at least you to see out what I'm saying, if I haven't answered completely. I think it's very clear that the jurisdictional boundaries of the respective regulators need to be they need to be clear, so that the responsibility and execution of the responsibility is clear. We want to look at it to ensure that, in terms of saying who's responsible for what. Then it's a question of, well, given the overlapping responsibilities, the inevitable overlapping responsibilities, how does that happen? We did go through an exercise of, at some stage, we're trying to map out in more detail legislatively about how exactly the coordination should happen. I think we also need to get to a point where our regulators recognize the regulators are grown-ups, and actually they can execute their responsibilities in a reasonable and accountable way. So the way the bill is crafted is not to expressly dictate how each and every bit of coordination or collaboration should happen, but more to require that conversation happens. And the conversation is upheld through the MOUs as they've been provided for, and that those MOUs must expressly provide for and cover these elements are covered in Section 76. It's not for us, I think, as government that also goes operational interference to say, for exactly
if you are about to take an action relating to the imposing a penalty on financial institutions, if you must be applying to, I think that the regulatory authority should be given flexibility, particularly given that each situation is often very different, to be able to work that out between themselves. That's not to say that there shouldn't be that only placed on them. I think.
Also, including public pressure on the funding committee?
Sorry, can you elaborate?
I'm saying including public pressure on funding committee. If, for instance, Prime Minister, there was collusion in the presidency and the public feels that this matter should be on the table of the regulator.
Sure.
The thing is that this matter will not draw the attention of. Because it will be a. It will be an issue that has not been planned before, but an issue that arises even when they proceed to their function.
I think that's a very important question, and I think it's one which we have thought hard about in order to ensure as well that we don't have an overly limited view of our supervisory responsibility. And not necessarily in terms of these provisions, but elsewhere in the bill we have explicitly provided or tried to accommodate exactly that. So earlier you would have spoken around obligations placed on the regulators to be reviewing regulatory scope. The perimeter, and the focus ultimately being not so much on just executing the law, but increasingly looking forward and proactively saying where is the prudential risk coming from, where is stability risk coming from, where is conduct risk coming from, and to then start taking the right measures and steps to address those risks. We also have provided extensively, and we can have further discussion around this. I think too often we also are our engagements, the channels of engagement have perhaps been overly narrow. And what we've been trying to provide for, we have provided for a broader reach of engagement. So for example, we've provided for panels of engagement not just with industry, but also with the consumer groups and the like. These are very important mechanisms in union illustratively to show how we expect the authorities to be increasingly reaching out to be taking stock of exactly where those risks and public increments is coming from in the public experience.
Thank you. Any further questions? Thank you.
Section 77 on the memorandum of understanding then talks to how, as I've just described, how these relationships are or these arrangements are to be described. It talks about that it needs to be 77.1. Must be introduced as soon as practical, not later than 6 months, in order to give effect to Section 76. It should describe that delegation can need to be described in terms of the MOU. The MOU needs to be updated and reviewed at least once every 3 years, as seen in Subsection 4. Subsection 5 provides for, the sharing of the MOUs with the respective agencies involved, as well as the respective ministers involved. And these agencies need to publish the MOUs and the amendments to that, so that, broadly speaking, there is a support for transparency again.
Can I just make the point? We do rely on these MOUs, but something that when you go to the UK you should look at is there's lots of MOUs between regulators, and do they really work? Okay. In fact, in the UK they had all those MOUs, and they clearly didn't work. And in a sense, I guess, the issue between regulators is to get the right culture. So what we found is, if you go to the UK today, their legislation, and I haven't checked the latest, but they actually, you know, the coordination failures were so marked that the new legislation actually told them how to work closely together, the whole comply or explain kind of provisions that, you know, one can tell you what to do and you know, Bank of England can tell, for example, that one of the regulators what to do, and if the regulator doesn't do what it's been told to do, then they've got to explain, okay, and publish and blah, blah, blah. Whereas at the other extreme, in Australia, you find there's such a strong culture of the regulators working together, and it helps that their offices are all within walking distance. The central bank in Sydney, the Prudential Authority, and ASIC, which is their financial, their conduct regulator and the securities regulator. So there's just a different culture that operates, and often realize it's one thing what the law says, it's more the culture and the practices of those who are who work as regulators is probably more important to ensure coordination. But so these are put there as minimum. Really, you expect much more from the regulators.
You emphasized the question of, I think, about the origin of the system, because it doesn't matter how many sort of
fixes
you put in place, it's how to observe and implement that. And we always need to preempt those, whether people will do it or not, it's another issue. So it's the issue of how you encourage the culture of collaboration more than any other thing.
Thank you, Chair. Section 78 again refers to unordered estate and requires that any of such bodies who have a regulatory supervisory function relating to a financial institution should consult the financial sector regulators and reserve bank in the performance of that function, particularly to the extent that it might impact on the execution of our financial sector regulator mandate. There's also a provision in Section 2 of being able to request information from such organ or state, and Section 3 then to that it should comply with such a request for information.
Any questions?
Shepherdson, I need your confidence. There's a way that we say use the on Section 77 subsection 1. That's in that sense we say eventually here. Then we go to 78 subsection 1. And what can we say has that has that we say also whatever function in relation to financial institution must to the extent flexible on that. So my question is who is to determine the practicality of this? Who is to determine this? I didn't see something like that.
So generally this is a reasonableness test, but I'll ask Janine to please respond from a pure legal perspective.
I think you understand what he is asking. He's trying to ask how you measure that stability.
Yeah. I suppose it's intended to convey that they must make an effort to come sort of reasonably possible. So it's putting an effort is that they must take steps and try to in 77 enter into a memorandum of understanding as soon as reasonably possible. There's other deadlines set there at 6 months. And 78 one use of practicable there it's indicating that they must consult them, you know, what may apply, what may be appropriate in particular circumstances may vary somewhat. So the use of the term is trying to sort of convey the possibility that it is somewhat dependent on circumstances. It is something that to find very clearly. So that we certainly understand that point and how we can consider if there is better wording to convey that. But the intention is to indicate that, you know, circumstances may involve maybe relevant or appropriate.
So it could be the competition solution. Maybe mention that this year's show, the Friday, is what the Conscious Voice Commission should also put in.
But we certainly don't use that for our consider the great more
now, I'm just going to share, I hope the, our standards because the two parties are involved in the conflict about what is happening. What might be practical to the other party might not be practical. You know, like a bill or an act that talk about may or no, no, reasonable time, something like that. And then somebody might have done something and said, hey, to me, this is not reasonable time. And somebody might challenge this. The other party might challenge this. Say, to me, it's not reasonable enough. So I'm just, you know, questioning. And such ways are opening up with every policy for argument.
That this Council of Regulators goes broader than just how the financial regulator defines this law, and necessarily so. So, Section 9.1 establishes Council, Section 9.2 states the objective of the Council to facilitate cooperation and collaboration, where appropriate constructive action between the institutions represented. And then in Subsection 3, the Council is defined as the Department of Finance DG or Treasury DG, DG for Trade and Industry, and as you can see that this then goes down to all the affected stakeholders, and it also provides the ability that additional persons can be brought into the group as a relationship. Can I possibly continue with a couple of just other
but just a sec, Kathy. You know, we first call this the Council of Financial Regulators, but I think many of the, you know, we try to make this a broad church of anyone who could impact on the financial sector to be part of this, so that as a forum to discuss issues or form subcommittees. But some of the regulators pointed out they don't just regulate the financial sector. So if you look at the Competition Commission, you look at, and they do different things perhaps. So, you know, we kind of then thought the Financial System Council of Regulators. So just thought we want to know that. Might come up in some of the discussion. I do get worried though in point 83, the DG must convene, it's there for the ESOC as well, the governor must convene if one person asks. I think we must just think about that. Yeah.
So, I think we probably just to flag, but for the Financial System Council of Regulators, as well as the ESOC, as we can cover it, that these are discussion bodies. They are not, they do not make binding decisions on the respective agencies involved, and that was an important and a deliberate consideration in order to ensure the continued operation and independence of the respective agencies involved as well. So, Section 80 then deals with the meeting. In Section
80. I know I'm differing with my team here, but they put mush all over where I think they should put milk. But let's come back on those issues, yeah.
Because after
my comment,
the word should be made.
Yes, yes. I think it should be made, yeah.
I'm leaving it to you to deal
yeah.
with it,
okay. So importantly, this talk probably applies to Morris, which is why he probably wants to make it.
The worst in the job. Can you imagine when the financial sector to the ministerial council would be a war zone?
What we are making strides to do, and I think that all goes to something to achieve, but it's to balance what Momo had previously described being the operational dependent, and the previous question of what is independent and are we qualifying independence. So between the operational dependence, independence, and being able as a regulator to be making operational decisions, can you issue a license, can you withdraw a license, can you impose a fine, to go on and ask my for this, etc. Those are all operational decisions, and those should be completely outside of the realm of the executive, for example. But that's not to say that that a particular regulator, like the Conduct Authority, can operate completely out of perspective of what is going, its actions are impacting stability, for example. It also doesn't mean that it should be operating completely outside of a policy framework as in fact agreed through the legislation, through the law framework as it is defined. And so what we have done, there are a number of examples in order to illustrate this, is you need that balance. So yes, you need to talk to each other, you need to be mindful of each other's objectives, but having said that, you must take decisions operationally separately. And there are specific clauses which were being covered earlier which go to that effect exactly, which say you, Conduct Authority, need to be able to operate completely freely, independently, separately, and the like. So of course you could ask, well, does that have meaning, doesn't it? But I think within the confines that we have, you need to learn that. So on, moving then back to, just a final point, I think, is that there are, there are obviously going to be times when regulators, given that the agencies have got their respective interests and the departments, given that those departments have got their respective interests, are going to be disagreeing. What's important and what's critical, though, is that, and that's normal, I think that's good, we should be testing each other, because that is how, it's healthy, because that's how we now get into the right outcome. And so what's important is that we don't hide behind closed doors, and in fact we do facilitate these types of discussions, and that these types of discussions not only happen, but they happen in a transparent and a fair way with these teachers and countries. So moving back then to the turning to Section 80, Section 80 describes how the meetings can or should happen. It looks to these meetings being held at least twice a year or more frequently as determined by the DG. The DG or an alternate will be chairing those meetings. Then, what the question that Momo had raised around the DG convening a meeting at the request of a member of the council. And this clause, although we could obviously discuss around whether appropriate or not, what we're also trying to do is ensure that there is a balance of power amongst the various parties. And the clause then was intended to ensure that it's not just, it's not a treasury driven forum, and in fact we're recognising that given the overlapping nature of the system and of these various agencies, that it's important that each of the respective persons representative or entity representative have a voice and have a fair voice. Subsection 4, these are subsection 4 and 5 then just talks about procedural issues. I'm going to move on to section 81. which talks about the establishment of working groups and subcommittees. I think the very nature of the meeting, the composition of the council as it's being described, suggests that that council is not going to be where the real needs of workers are. And so therefore it's important that in 811A through G, describe where it needs, we know we need work to be done, and collaboration must happen. And that talks to enforcement and financial crime, stability and resolution, policy and legislation, standard setting, financial outcomes, and financial inclusion. And then lastly, section 82 just provides.
When we were dealing with the financial, with financial legislation, if you recall, I think we had tons of advisory committees, and they were specified the minister had to appoint each and every one of them. So we've just sort of had to make the advisory side less prescriptive from a legislative point of view, because frankly, if you legislate that people should just meet to provide advice, frankly, it actually doesn't work. If somebody really wants advice, then make sure it will work. But it just enables those problems to actually be started as and when they're required.
Section 82 provides the conduct of those who would provide the initiative. Before we go to part three, Part 3 then deals with interministerial council, and section 83. 2, provides the objective, again being cooperation and collaboration, and the members of the Interministerial Council being the Minister, the Cabinet Member responsible for consumer protection and consumer credit matters, and the Cabinet Member responsible for health, as well as economic development. Section 84 then describes how these meetings will take place. Section 85, provide a right for the cabinet members responsible for consumer protection and consumer credit to request that council, the interministerial council, to consider, in effect, whether standards provided for in terms of the financial sector laws are high and meet the baseline standard as provided for the consumer protection law. And then section 86 provides for the Interministerial Council to require an independent evaluation of the effectiveness of cooperation and collaboration between the regulator, the financial sector regulators, the Reserve Bank, the FIC, and the Health and Medical Scheme and Competition Commission. Okay. Performing your functions. And part part of the performance of these functions is will relate to how they work with each other. And the question we have, or we had it and we continue to have, and we would welcome feedback on this as well, is how do we ensure that the regulators, it then comes down to that balance, right? How do we ensure that the regulators are performing their functions effectively, but not doing so completely unilaterally, and at the same time operating not only within the policy framework, but within a framework recognizing that these different regulators have got some roles and responsibilities.
What technology is there today? What do you foresee as a challenge by
the I'm trying to get to the whole question of the extent to which there could be interference in the regulators by the executive. So let me take the argument a little bit further. The independent evaluation, they determine the regulators are not cooperating. What then?
So what the bill does not provide for is that there are definitive steps of interference using that the council may take. So it is not empowered to start telling the regulators on an ad hoc basis what to do. The expectation would be that this would, given that these regulatory agencies operate again within an accountability structure, this would surely be one of those one of the tools with which to effectively and in a transparent and uninterfering way hold the regulators to account. Keep in mind as well that what we're responsible for is policy and legal framework, right? But what we're finding, and this using this illustrative, is that in our weaknesses, we need to identify what is the policy and legal framework, never mind on an individual accountability basis of the regulators, are there weaknesses? And if we find that there are weaknesses, well, then those need to be tested. And then not to deliberately interfere with the actions of the regulator, but to take the appropriate steps in terms of the policy and law.
Oh,
chapter 6 is again a relatively short chapter. Concise and to the point, but very important. What it talks to are administrative actions. And in effect, it provides for, and just going to the slides now, for administrative action procedures to guide or to ensure that administrative actions are taken in a fair and consistent way. That is not to say that the charter does not apply. Of course, the charter applies. The charter all applies. These administrative action procedures should be consulted upon, again, supporting transparency and accountability. And we provide for the establishment of administrative action committees to, in effect, be an additional source of expertise and independent decision-making. And by independent meaning, I think what we are requiring of our regulators is that those who are often directly involved in the day-to-day supervision should not be, there should be an arm's length between that person and ultimately the person who decides to take the administrative action in order to ensure fairness. So the final bullet then provides all these administrative action committees which can consider and make recommendations on administrative approval by the authority, and that is to ensure strength in decision making, strength and fairness in decision making. So, looking into the clauses, section 87 provides for the establishment of these administrative action committees to make recommendations to the regulator. Subclause 2 provides that the regulator may delegate to the committee the power to impose administrative penalties specified in the delegation. Subclause 3 calls for the members of these committees, and which must include a judge, an advocate with experience, persons who are not members of the Prudential Committee, all the executive committee staff members, again, to ensure it should be a matter of independence and the right authority and experience. That is further supported by sub-clause 4, which talks to who may be appointed as a chairperson of the Administrative Action Committee. And then finally, sub-clause 5 talks to a disqualified person may not be appointed to one of these Administrative Action Committees.
I'm going to turn this over. What is a disqualified person? You know, I know the institution where a person who has been declared a liar by a judge who's getting everything from the institution. So it is happening.
Do you want us to answer?
I don't know. But I'm not using an example because it happens. It's a person who has been declared a liar by a judge. And yet he is in the institution.
Well, the responsible general principle is that if someone is disqualified person, should they, what can happen?
So, generally, most of the committees that are established in Brazil, and that's one reason why we set out the definition of disqualified person at the commencement of the year. And it took, extended that to make it very clear the criteria for members of the committee. And we tried to clearly say that only persons who are not disqualified can be a member. If a person, for whatever reason, becomes a disqualified person, then their membership must be terminated. In some instances, we have expressly stated that they would have to be removed immediately, but we can check all of the provisions to make sure that outcome would be explicitly clear. The intention would certainly be that they would not continue to be a member of the committee.
But then how do you tighten the system that he doesn't use the very same institution as money to fight that and appeal in court? I'm trying to give a practical example. I don't know if I should say names of people here, but some of you know what I'm talking about. It will happen.
Yeah.
I think for us, if they're using things to ensure that there are people remain, if they disqualify that they're not there, because if they don't participate in a Administrative Action Committee, they're imposing a fine, the proceedings would be justiciable and reviewable on procedural grounds to say that that person's out there. So I think it's an incentive for the oversight and the executive management to ensure, to take reasonable action to ensure that the person's not there.
So we are on...
So why don't we do the discussion and then I'll pick up the meeting.
Yeah.
But can I mention something?
What's
okay, I went out and I came back and I can report to you that it seems that the strike is sorted out. Resolved, right? So don't underestimate the SAC. As soon as I went out and came back, the strike is over. Now I'm looking at it, I gather the strike is over. That's my basic reason to say. Finish the subject today.
Yeah. No, what I was thinking about is that on this subject, subject is not speak about a disqualified person. Women will participate in this committee. So I was giving an example to them that there's an instance where a person has been declared a liar by a judge, and is participating as a very important institution. And you also have a case of somebody who was declared to be unfit for all positions, but just by a court of law, but there's one fellow to actually challenge that using the very state funds to do that. So I'm saying how they tax that, that such things doesn't happen. I don't know. It might not be there. I'm not trying to make it day to day, you know. I'm just trying to do my work.
I think the point when I said the whole process of appointment and getting the panel report fit and proper and so on can be a way that we're, because it is important, if you may be fit and proper at the time, but then get appointed and something happens, there needs to be a more automatic process, because you disqualify, you disqualify. So perhaps we can look at that. Yeah, I think it's a fair point.
So clauses 88 and 89 are then again procedural. Section 88 deals with terms of membership, who may be appointed and how in the terms of office. So 88.1 talks about, and this is for a non, someone who is not looking for the regulator, for a period not exceeding 5 years, and on terms including terms regarding remuneration determined by the financial sector regulator. Subsection 2 talks about reappointment, that person can be reappointed upon expiry. Subsection 3 talks about the process for removing a member, and these are all various governance processes, checks and dusting down there, and making sure that the right people are in the right position and not abusing. 89 deals with meetings, how those meetings are to be heard. Section 90 then talks about adaptation to the ombuds regulatory function. Are there any questions? Part 2 then goes on to, we've already spoken about part job knowledge, so section 91, references exactly that. Section 92.1, or section 92, then talks about procedures and what it provides for, that the regulator can determine procedures in a fair and transparent way to aim at promoting consistency and basically harmony, what's the word, homogeneity in the way that things are taken. Section 93 then again relates to the submission of action procedures and the way in which these procedures can be changed. Section 94 is an interesting one, and that talks to the reconsideration of decisions. And this is to ensure that the regulator may in fact reconsider a decision that's made without going through a full initiative action process procedure, and that's in the interest of time and money, basically. And then section 95 again deals with interpretation. Before moving on, just a question around what we provided for here, just that you understand the comparability, is the it's a revision or a refinement and improvement on the current enforcement committee as provided for in terms of the as currently being employed by the financial service board. So if you would like, we could see to maybe expand on how this changes the enforcement committee, please.
Then, sorry, so just to add on to 94, which is reconsideration of decisions, that is known as functus officio, and it is the wording that follows judgment in what was known as the Curtin case. What happened in that case is that the SCAR was given permission to build hospitals, started building hospitals, and then the relevant MP decided later that wasn't allowed to build a hospital, so he withdrew the approval for an a decision. And there was a very interesting court case around it, and certain requirements were laid down by the Constitutional Court in terms of when decisions could be altered, substituted, or revoked, and we've tried to follow that as far as possible. I don't know if any Janine or Joanne want to add on to, or Raksha, if you want to add on to that. No? Maybe if you want to follow in person? I knew Ethel Jen could ask that.
Did you hear what he said?
Yes. Can I ask you,
Okay, so we are moving on into chapter 2.
Alright, so this is... Right, okay, fine. Can I just ask something quickly? Can I just draw your attention to this member? The aim is to finish the book for 5 before we have these public hearings. Now, we should try to get as much done as possible today. And if we don't, then tomorrow at 2 o'clock I will forget to start again. But whatever happens tomorrow, we'll finish. So, some of the things are pretty banal, like confusion, but they don't have, right? But regulating its instruments, this is important, this is standard here, right? So this is what I would like to suggest is, can you use your discretion also in how much you explain each plot? So this I think is quite important. Yeah. So we'll go through the 96 is 24, right? 97.
Okay. So
regulatory
instruments
and or... Thank you, sorry. Thank you, Danny.
Thank you, Chair and Chair.
Okay, yeah. Oh, yeah, there you go.
Yeah, we have
the slide. Right, so we start with the slide. What the bill provides for is a streamlined version and a consistent application of, in effect, rulemaking powers by the regulators. Here's where we are today. So where we come from today is that the various registrars, I'm not even talking between ABC and the Reserve Bank, if we're talking about the registrars, depending on what law you look at, there are different rulemaking powers, and those rulemaking powers are described in different ways for different levels of, there's different levels of those powers, and consultation requirements generally differ as well. So for example, the Bank Act generally supported regulation is made by minister-issued regulation. And there's a certain set of process that happens there. Compared to, for example, the Collective Investment Scheme Control Act, where primarily subordinate regulation is made by the registrar responsible for collective investment schemes. What we've seen is a fairly ad hoc implementation of, for example, consultation. So depending on which registrar it is, we'll adopt a very different consultation process of those requirements at which. So again, now what Chapter 7 is particularly important to us, because what it does is it provides for the conduct authority and the prudential authority to properly exercise the objectives and functions as have been placed upon them, and it does so in a way which standardizes the approach to what are the federal making powers of ordinance regulations. Also, it's important to identify that these standards are an overlay to powers that are applied to the existing federal legislation. And the intent being that it applies that. So the prudential authority can issue prudential standards, including to maintain financial stability, matters dealing with liquidity leverage, risk management, and capital, and we'll talk through exactly what task knowledge can approach. The conduct authority, on the other hand, takes stands for its role and responsibility, which deals with the full value chain of products from the design through to the advice, intermediation, disclosure, transparency, and the like. There's an important innovation which South Africa is proposing, and that is this concept of joint standards, whereby because of the significant overlap on some issues, for example, fit and proper requirements, governance requirements, whereby both the prudential authority and the conduct authority are going to have similar types of requirements, fit and proper, but applying a different lens. Fit and proper from a product perspective might be slightly different to what's fit and proper from a prudential perspective. So we need both institutions involved, but that doesn't mean that you want to completely separate the standards, because there's such a significant degree of overlap that it might be inefficient and ineffective. And again, this is just a flexibility, considering flexibility. And then, as I've already highlighted, harmonizing the process for the issuing of these regulated standards by hard-coding a minimum consultation process, which is then leading very easily to the tools by tools, which if we look at section 97, talks to exactly that. Before making a regulated instrument, the maker of trust must publish a draft of the regulatory instrument, a statement explaining the need for and intended operation of that, a statement of the effective impact, the notice inviting commissions, the period of allowance, etc. In effect, what we are providing for is an extensive consultation process, and we think that this is an important check in terms of, given that the extensive and meaningful powers and rights are shown in terms of delivering on the operation, gaining the operational independence, that are the right checks and balances. Subclause 3A then talks about the cooperation and coordination between the respective agencies. Subsection 4 applies reference to the Ombud Regulatory Council. And this might be stated obvious, but subsection 5 requires that the maker of the instrument take into account all of the submissions. Moving on to, and I'll just go through a couple because they're related to each other, and then we'll ask take questions. Section 98. Section 98 then requires that not only a new regulatory instrument, but that regulatory instrument is being changed, and it requires a similar procedural procedure. And section 9 then refers to urgent regulatory instruments, because of course, going through the extensive consultation is going to take time. There are cases where we need to be taking immediate intervention, and section 99 provides that with the appropriate checks. Section 100, this then goes to the role of the National Assembly, or the role of Parliament generally, talks about what in effect provides that role, where the regulatory instrument must be submitted through to Parliament with a statement explaining its need, expected impact, and expected impact. Section 101, so I'll just continue to continue. So section 101, then all this consultation process itself has taken place. It requires a report of that consultation process, again strengthening the transparency, including a general account of issues raised and a response on issues raised in the submission. Alright, I think that's
okay. Questions again? Can I just ask you a quick question? I mean, this is covered in this case, Mr. Forward, you can talk over the phone with Roy, or you or whatever. Regulatory instrument, what does that actually mean? There's no definition of regulatory instrument. What is regulatory instrument? I looked on the R,
so
I'll
give you the
control
response before we find the definition. A regulatory instrument.
There's no, under R, R-E-G, there's nothing. Right. I can't read. Okay, there goes it.
But in effect, and why this is important, an important question, is that there are standards being made in terms of this law, which we'll get to now, but there are a plethora of other standards, in effect, rulemaking funds provided for all the sectoral laws under Bank Act, the Long-Term Insurance Act, Short-Term Insurance Act, etc. And what is important is the standardization of the way in which those instruments are made. So irrespective of whether it's whether you're making a policyholder protection rule in terms of the Long-Term Insurance Act, or whether you're making a conduct standard on disclosure in terms of this Act, the consultation processes should apply. And for the purposes of this Act, all of those things are referred to as regulated instruments.
That's the question. What's the difference between regulated instrument and regulation? Is it a regulated instrument is an instrument of regulation, a form of regulation. Is that what it is? Why don't you simply say regulation? I just want to ask, I don't follow the rules. What was the answer?
I'll hand over to Neil, but just to highlight this and just to cover the...
Sorry, I didn't really catch this. Yeah, great.
Jimmy?
The term regulation is used specifically to refer to regulations that are made by and it's used consistently in that context. And so what we're referring to as regulatory instruments are instruments that are made by regulators, not by the minister, but the legislation specifically authorizes the regulator to make what we're referring to in this legislation as standard. And in other financial sector laws, they're currently being referred to as rule or other types of instruments that. And so it's distinguishing the distinction between what the minister can make in terms of subordinate legislation and what the regulator may be authorized in terms of legislation to make. So we refer to, define the term regulatory instruments to strictly include those instruments that the regulators are making and not the minister.
Okay. Ask a question. In other words, is it the case that all regulations are done by the minister? All that happens is the regulators give instrumental expression of such a term to those regulations? Or do you also have latitude to have some regulations done by the regulators that are not inconsistent with what the minister's regulations are? In other words, is it simply that you have these instruments that you regulate whose regulations are determined by a minister, or do you also have some latitude beyond instruments to also regulate? Because that's what I thought you can do. You can regulate.
Yes.
You don't just fulfill the function of regulatory instruments. But if you think it's covered under the rule, I can talk about that this week. I just want to
say, I also have a question about the intention of the submission of the regulatory instruments to the offender. The scope, the extent that this will be done, we need to check that to whether you have the cause or whether the national assembly will have the power to monitor the work that the regulatory will be doing. It is just information that it is not captured in the subsequent. It just says to copy the rest of the film. It just says information.
Mm-hmm.
And there is intention that we need to increase the way of the regulations.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
But somebody can ask a question. We are going to learn the regulations, we just get a copy of the regulations and then what we do with it. It might align to your question.
Can I ask something? The term used anywhere else in any other book, regulatory instrument. It links the broader theme of where do the powers of the minister begin and end,
yes.
And where do the powers of the regulator begin and end. It's not a big issue here. I can see a big part of the political problem of the regulator, right? And you have to clear what you think. So is it that we're anywhere else? I've never come across this term in any other book that I've seen familiar.
It isn't, but that's deliberate. So I think there are a couple of issues which are being raised. So firstly, if the minister would only have regulating, you can think about it as a big R, regulation, he can set rules which become a big law.
Yeah.
This is a shame. This is saying that the Prudential Authority and the Conduct Authority can set requirements, and those requirements are in effect law. We can have a much more nuanced discussion around is there a hierarchy or not, but in effect that's what it translates into. The reason then is a question of term. So firstly, there's a conceptual question, is that correct? And we can have a discussion around what are the appropriate powers for a regulatory authority to have. And we considered in line, firstly, with operational functioning, ensuring that it is most flexible, can most effectively respond to emerging risks, is truly operationally independent. We preferred, and it's considered with international standards as well, we preferred the route that actually the authority should have those powers. And the authority then, rather than setting its rules on isolation or the rulemaking powers, should be judged as an authority in the exercise of their functions in an appropriate way. And we've created the right checks and balances to do that. On the one hand, the authority works as a whole, but also the consultation process has become increasingly important as well. It provides transparency as well as, it gives additional transparency. The related question then is around the term regulatory instruments. Is that term best? And going back to what Wanda aims is in standardizing or harmonizing the approach for the issuing of subordinate regulation, we needed a term which was actually not used somewhere else, because otherwise it ended up becoming that term in terms of understanding. So we regulatory instruments is chosen so that we can be absorbing all these other instruments which are in place already, but they do the same thing, but they just call different names. So when we talk about a board notice issued by the FSC, or a notice issued by the FSC, or rules issued by the FSC, on the soft side, the SOC issues directives which in effect are used like rules slash notices slash board notices. So what that means is that it's been difficult to harmonize our approach to the rulemaking powers, given that they're provided for in very different ways across the state and used in very different ways across the state law. So
So regulatory instruments being chosen to replace all those while we're going through this interim phase of streamlining the various electoral law and the 20 that will be settled on.
So these were often called rules in other pieces of legislation. So the word terminology in the Insurance Act, the Short Term Insurance Act, the Long Term Insurance Act, these are things like the policyholder protection rules. But because they're used so differently in different pieces of legislation, we've used slightly different terms.
Yes, sir. We are trying to standardize, and you know, part of it is getting what I said. Every act has its own terminology, or different terminology, and you know, what's the status of that? And bear in mind, some of this, you know, to the extent it's a sort of subordinate legislation or not, it's really what applies to the regulator. So it applies to the subject of those who have been licensed and will come to a section of licensing, and hence using terminology also like standards. So that certainly I think is one sort of area that we try to standardize. And, yeah.
Yeah.
All right, maybe it's just me. I don't fully understand what you're saying. Just a simple question. Apart from regulation influence, does the good regulator have power to make regulations as such?
Currently, the regulators or the industry or the regulatory branch have got power to...
No, I mean in the judges as well.
Yes. No.
All right, okay.
So regulations, no. Regulations on the information
and that is
currently the case from the point. All right, fine. Okay, I
don't
understand. It's fine. I'm sure
as
I listen to other people
in
the
public hearing, though. No, but Chair, just to answer your question completely, so the question is where do regulations stop and standards for example start is really the issue. So there's degrees of, you know, is it a regulation with a big R or is it one with a small R? Okay.
All right, fine.
I don't want to continue until we understand. Am I correct to think that regulatory instruments in this context means rules that will be made by regulators?
Yes.
But they don't use the term rules.
Yes.
What is the power of Parliament to amend these regulation instruments? We can have public hearings, at least we can signal to you, hey, you guys may have got it wrong, listen, these people are upset. But do we have, you see, the reason why Tom is raising it, in Parliament between the year 1999 and 2004, this issue was a big issue. Frank, were you here then? Yeah. The issue was, what Fridgen Waller drew to our attention, the Speaker of the time, was, what an executive does is that if it feels it's going to lose out to Parliament on some particular provision of a bill, they then put it under regulation, right? Now they're losing out, and this guy was going to use that over time. And the municipal legislation, one of the earlier legislation justice really said, certain regulations are for noting for Parliament, and all we can do Because it's consistent with what the Act completely is notice, we can have public hearings, we can submit to the executive those public hearings, but the executive is not obliged to do anything about it. There's another category of regulations, and that's what we do with the Systems Act, I think, where we said no. The regulation is a draft regulation in these areas, and it will be submitted to Parliament, and we will treat it like we treat any other clause in a bill. The committee has to agree and Parliament has to agree with it. So it depends on the category of regulation. So what Chandi is rightly asking, what we do with it, and what you're saying, you can do whatever you want, but hey, you can't change it, I think, is the idea, right? This is a matter we need to look at, right? I personally don't think we should have endless debates about these things. And the way we're going to coach it, yeah, different people are under different sides, and I don't think all of us will be all the time. We're not going to go back to square one. Although it's an issue of forum, the parameters are being set for taking the discussion forward. So we don't start again and say, you know, and the same question we had now, we have it in February next year. If we have Bridget here and we have the secretary here, they're going to do minutes, but not the normal minutes. Sandy said this, and William said this, and Sharon said this, and so on. It will be like a proper overview report. And then members must come and look at the thing and they say, we're not asking the same questions again. So I'm just saying to you that I think that's quite an issue. It is a quite an important issue. I don't really understand it, but if I don't understand it, everybody else understands my problem. Mm-hmm. I will speak to the Sami. If he and I both don't understand, we'll bring you another teleconference with you.
Right, over to you, Mr. Mania.
From clause 100, you use the term ineffective regulatory instruments to submit to the National Assembly. Is that intentional? Submit as opposed to take?
I did not. No, so on the part one, we are done except for the last question.
Yeah. Can I just answer this question and I'll say something?
The intention is that it is provided to the National Assembly for its scrutiny. In terms of the choice of words, we don't have a problem with being table or submission. I don't think it would be a good intention.
Can I just say, for instance, that legally there is a distinction between submit and table, isn't that correct? Or no?
Chairperson, any member of Parliament or member of the National Assembly can table something in the National Assembly. I mean,
right.
The rules are, so the Minister of Finance tables their station, and the Speaker must table all other instruments submitted to the National Assembly, including both. So in terms of Parliament's rules, we will determine what must be tabled. Although it's been used in legislation, the Minister must table something. And ministers can, even ministers who are not members of the National Assembly, they can table because they're ministers and the legislation says we must table. But usually submit, table, it comes here, in other words, and if it's not tabled by that member, if it must be submitted by a regulatory authority, in this case, or a DG, then the Speaker must have by simply doing, to be honest, we do the tabling, we write it in the ACC and the table.
I think the effect of what I'm asking is to say there's no difference between the word table and submit insofar as the power of the committee or Parliament as a whole is concerned. So I'm asking if you table, then is there a requirement that parliamentary committees have a say on the matter and would like the executive to come? If you submit, then Parliament doesn't have the power. So in short, whether you submit or table is interchangeable, there's no legal meaning to it that you think.
If we want to get a different meaning to a person, then one would say that the committee never gets referred to must consider and put.
Yeah, okay, fine.
But that's a different story.
There might not be a legal decision between the two terms, although I'm not sure that I agree with that, but there is a practical implication. So for many years, the National Conventional Committee submitted its reports to the Joint Standing Committee on Tips directly,
right.
And they then refused to distribute them to members of the committee or to the National Assembly for years. So it's something that we might want to address.
Mike, Tony?
Actually, I don't know where it was going when you asked this question. You see, when the report is tabled, it will be ATC, it will then go to the National Assembly, and it will be considered if there is any. But there is an element of submission in the context of information. That's why I was asking this question. Because once you bring something to the National Assembly, you want to give it a strategy. So if you're not clear the timing here, what you want to do with it, it will get adjusted to different interpretations. Not legal interpretation, but political interpretations. The control, well, our social interactive church, the defense portfolio committee, when you look at here. You're not here yet. There was a convention among members that can be considered in the committee, and there is no that I'm talking about, but I'm talking about convention, because of the nature of the issues that were discussed. In the context, it's more about packaging of armaments, which is very difficult discussion between countries who do a transaction. So, in national interest, you would not want to take such information in front of the public. But this is agency is for the public, right? So, we'll want to look at how you want to couch, why you would want this instrument to make a submission to the National Assembly. This is for information that then I'm taking some public to explain how you do it. It's not necessarily table. It's submitted for information, for consideration. There's specific legal matter that goes with that. So, maybe you can set it for a discussion.
Yeah, no, look, I think we need some more on this. I think there is a distinction, like a few have said, between tabling and submitting. That's the way I understood it. The three entities are saying that. But look, we're not lawyers. It's fine. Fine, it doesn't matter. It depends on what you want from this as a commission. So we will apply it as it were. So we're going to note that. Can you move on to standards, please?
Because I do want to endorse. I think that this is really an important issue, and I think the role of Parliament comes in. And in a sense, you don't want the potential for abuse as well. And I think that for all of these reasons, I was going to ask Roy. At the time we published the bill, we did publish a document to try and explain some of these chapters.
Mm.
I just wonder whether for members we shouldn't circulate
yes.
that. It probably needs to be updated, but it sort of tries to deal with some of the issues, maybe not as in the detail that we'd want, but it's meant to explain this in some way. I think the other thing is, because if you look at the financial sector and the standards and the gaudy detail, what's not sustainable is that, like we have this explosion of legislation come, that we need to do all the work that every time the regulators do something that it needs to come here and down to an act which has been part of the tradition.
Yeah.
So we want to also just develop an approach. What do we want to legislate as primary legislation? What do we want as regulations and whatever process by the minister? And what can we leave to the regulators? And I use the word, then you know who's asked to keep as well and who's responsible for what.
Look, it's not good.
Okay.
Fine, kind of use a permission that you come back. Not my number five. Let's move it, please.
Part two in the office of the standards and powers, and these then go to the requirements for the requirements that can be set and in effect become law through this act on financial institutions. The term standards is again deliberate. The term rules tend to have historically a very compliance focus, and increasingly we're moving to a world where we don't just want compliance with the rules, we want compliance with the spirit of the law. So what we see moving forward, and what we're already developing through the Prudential Framework, and increasingly we'll start seeing on the Conduct Framework as well, is a combination of binding principles and rules. And what we're seeing is, conceptually, what we are saying is that it's not enough to just be compliant with the rules. Almost we're seeing the standards and minimum standards. Based on terms and giving effect to the principle and spirit of the law that it's trying to achieve. The Prudential Standards then, the section 105 deals with the Prudential Standards. The Prudential Authority may make Prudential Standards for in respect of financial institutions, market infrastructure, significant owners, and key persons, aimed at ensuring safety and soundness, reducing the risk that both financial institutions and the like can contribute towards financial crime, and assist in maintaining financial stability. Now, section 2 then elaborates on what that means.
that are linked to financial soundness requirements, requirements of the Tukapa, and the like.
Okay, yeah. Can I ask colleagues, one of five, any comments, questions, contributions? No. Good. 106?
106, I'm sorry, just an additional point to answer what Michael was saying. But I think these devastating powers are really one of the main interventions that a regulatory authority can make in achieving what its objectives. And we therefore have taken in the view that it's very important that the regulatory authority does have these devastating powers. Section 106 deals with the conduct standards, so again, our financial institutions, representatives of financial institutions, contractors and the like. Obviously aims at something different. Now this is to achieve the conduct authority objectives, so talk to the efficiency and integrity of financial markets, ensuring that financial institutions and representatives treat financial customers fairly, reducing the risk of crime and maintaining financial stability. Then subject to two, then elaborate on what we mean. What type of scandal are we talking about? The same deal with what we had on the slide, which is what we look at here. And then the second book to the relationship, establish the relationship between the financial institutions and the customer, dealing with product design, advice, intermediation, disclosure, and the like. Section 3 is important to do from a conduct perspective because it says you can declare specific conduct to be unfair business conduct under the following parameters. It's likely or material and consistent with the best reasons of customer and the like, it's deceiving and misleading. And then Subsection 4 deals with conduct standards made in relation to financial institutions regulated under the Credit Act. And in effect, what it's doing is ensuring alignment between what's provided for in the credit law and what's proposed in terms of jurisdiction under this law. Section 107 deals with joint standards, which I've already spoken about, so where there's overlapping areas of interest that potential authority and conduct authority can make a joint standard. An example would be fit and proper, and that's what all governance requirements generally would be the obvious one. And then section 108 deals with...
Before we get to that, can we just deal with 106, 107?
Sure.
Any questions? No? 108?
108 is continued illegal making power... Well, here we're looking at all the discussion. These are standard-setting powers. Of course, I'm standard-setting powers which will apply to both the conduct authority and the confidential authority. These really are the matters of overlapping interest. Thing up to proper governance, operational requirements, control functions, and the like.
Christian, yes. But 109.
109 is a particularly interesting one because it talks to the jurisdiction of the conduct authority to make standards on payment services, and there was interest expressed earlier on payment services. And so this is a new area for what will become the conduct authority. And given the extreme sensitivity and risk stability of the payment system, requirements made on payment services need the concurrence of the Reserve Bank. And then section 110 is I think it's clearly that it's self-explanatory and you can make different damage to different countries.
Okay, any questions on the remaining different parts?
No.
Okay, chapter 8, live moving on.
I'm either about diminution of fees. SASA in the context that involves in the diminution of fees, but it's only about payments that they get involved in diminution of fees.
I think if it's a new legislation, okay. Yes, even though what I said is look, we're still finalizing the approach, but in a way the two regulators will have to meet, sign on their budgets, etc. Okay. Currently, each one has a specific budget. So the SARB, because it holds the capital from the banks, uses that, as you said, the interest and so on, to effectively fund its supervisory activity. But remember, that's restricted to banking supervision. Part of this conversation, and this I would treat some of it as a transitional discussion, is what part of the FSB moves over that is currently funded within the fees that the FSB charges. Okay, so we'll have to establish what the baseline is, and that's a function of the legislation as well, whether it's passed in this form, what will that be. Thereafter, of course, you've got to have the two authorities working together. I think you have to get the Treasury, etc., to be working on that. Now, regulators will say that they have that the executive shouldn't interfere in that process, okay? Because it gets back to independence, and the standards tend to differ. And as I said, when they say they're independent, some for independence mean they do their own budget. But like in Australia, the market conduct regulator also gets their funds through the... They have fees, but the fiscus is sort of involved in that way. Okay. So, to answer your question, we haven't finalized the arrangement, but certainly they will have to get more involved than they've... And currently, they're really not.
Well, I license this and get this slide perfectly. But you can go on easily looking, eh?
And then this is the proportion of a bank balance sheet that borrows. So a bank will borrow. So if a bank borrows money, that is leverage. It's got leverage. Or it's borrowing legal.
More than that.
Technically, it is the proportion of a bank balance sheet that's issued in debt among equity, so you can derive it from the debt-equity ratio. It's important because in the crisis, what happened is that banks that had borrowed heavily failed more than banks.
It's basically a debt-equity ratio.
Yeah,
basically.
Oh, sorry.
Then based on what debt-equity ratio,
it's okay, more common.
They use the word need, which is critical.
You don't
borrow unless you've got some
leverage.
Yeah.
Yes.
I mean, that means, well,
certainly
your borrowing is limited by
lack of
equity.
Well, is it
similar
to collateral that the bank is talking about?
Certainly
more likely that.
Is it?
Yes, you disagree.
Crudely. You go away with those collateral. For those of us who go to a bank,
remember,
they say, to you, okay, you want a housing loan? What collateral? Well, I've got a salary and I've got some assets. Is that right? Mm. Is that the estimate term?
Yeah, then that's collateral.
Sorry?
That would be collateral.
Yeah.
Leverage would be how much you borrow.
Yeah,
but it's not just how much you borrow and how much you lend on. So you can't, when you, they say you're levering, you don't just raise money from capital. You're taking money you've borrowed from the market, but then you also sort of levering it up and lending it out.
Yeah.
Isn't it?
Yes.
Yes.
I do not have a different
interpretation.
What I want
you to do is look at Wikipedia. That's the other.
Okay, tell me quickly.
You need to pay it back. So the problem is, so in terms of the lever, what you said was that it presumes you can pay it back, whereas the problem with leverage gets too high that sometimes you can't. And the connectedness within the system means that the more you borrow to everybody else, borrow to everybody else, that someone can't pay back. And that's the problem.
Yeah. I was going to say the leader. Okay. Latin, chapter 8. So I think it's important before we start explaining what we've done, is to explain how the world works at the moment. There are multiple licensing people, licensing authorities, and essentially they've boiled down to four in the current world. It's the Council for Medical Schemes, the National Credit Regulator, the Reserve Bank, and the Financial Services Board. What we are proposing is a slight reorganization, that there will still be four, and the Council of Medicines, NGR, but that the Prudential Authority will take on licensing responsibilities for certain pieces of legislation, and the Financial Sector Conduct Authority will take on licensing responsibilities for other pieces of legislation. So the easy ones are the Banks Act, the Mutual Banks Act, the Cooperative Banks Act, and something called the Financial Supervision of the Road Accident Fund Act. Those become the responsibility of the Prudential Authority.
It's all the regular bank of it.
Yes.
Everything else belongs to
the fiscal.
Yes. Okay.
All those things.
Why do you include long-term insurance? Then?
Yeah, that gets a little bit difficult. So the long-term insurance acts and the short-term insurance acts certain parts of it of prudential, so they relate to the health of the insurer.
Oh, yeah, they help.
Yeah, and certain parts of it relate to how the insurer sells the product. There's a chapter in the law called the policyholder protection rules chapter. So that's the only piece of legislation that's a little bit complicated and we have to divide up. The others actually work quite neatly. However, we will be, in our relentless quest to bring more legislation to this committee, we will be bringing another piece of legislation to the committee, which is the insurance bill, which is coming through.
I'm doing something. I'll tell the members I'm doing it. I'll talk to Minister Rob Daly and ask him, is it correct that they have some difficulty with the thing, the DG and him. I spoke to them there, I'll talk to them to me. The response was, the National Credit Regulator, as far as they know, is fine in this bill, and they don't, nobody's ever said that the issue of credit should be taken out of this. They may not be altogether happy with the formulations, but there isn't an issue. So I'll ask the DG and the ministers to the NCR. They are coming to public hearings, right? If they have right to come to public hearings, you can stop them, but it falls on the entity to make that call. The minister must not be misrepresented yet.
Why not underrun the chief press?
Well, don't underestimate the SEC. You're going to report me to the SEC in chief book and tell it, yeah, the chairperson is getting badly. I used to make something clear to you, colleague. In the 1 hour that I went out there and came back, the strike was suspended, right? It's not completely put off, it's suspended until Friday. And that happened in the 1 hour I was away here. So I was very happy to go for the commission. So all the APR, they are free to come to the election, but hopefully the minister will discuss with them the parameters to do with the microservice issue. Okay, over then to the court by court.
Quickly, all it is that the first bullet.
Okay, before you do, there's no time we can issue today, the house. Around 6. Yeah, I get it. But around 6, right? Right. So, sorry? Yeah, the question on us members, right, is your stamina and your appetite. Now, in 45 minutes, you can rush through this thing and finish it. Or the alternative is, we're not asking for your entire honesty here, that we reconvene at 2 tomorrow, and whatever happens, we'll have finished within 2 hours, right? So one of you can come tomorrow. What I'm asking is, you members want to rush through, can I get some guidance? Brendan, don't be disruptive. You come here and you're disruptive. Now, you don't have any discipline, unlike an ANC. The question is, do we want to rush through this in 45 minutes, or do we want to go to the pace we are and finish tomorrow while the house is sitting?
Do
you ask anything, Brendan? You just come in, you are no credibility. What are you doing? You are not sitting here, right? I refuse to allow you to speak until the others are spoken. From the others, so Brendan just rose here and he wants to put his hand up there. What? What? Most of the time. Or they won't be 6 o'clock. So then we can finish today. Okay. Starting with the chair, I'm going to be very laconic. I know you don't believe it, but I'm capable of that. Right. Over to you. 20.
So just chair clarification, are we finishing tomorrow or not?
We're trying to finish today because it's more than 45 minutes. Alright, is it impossible? It's impossible. Right, fine, go for it. Let's see how far we can get.
Right.
Final decision is we seek to finish before the half runs.
If we do, I'll
break it. Okay, I don't want to influence your decision, but we are exactly halfway through the ball.
Those are consequential.
No, after
the
principle. Actually,
can we go ahead
and
look at the big deal?
But
Ambit
is the second part of that.
Alright, fine, David, I get that. Basically, can I summarize? I'm neutral on the matter. DA seems to be neutral. Digital Lady, we don't know where she stands.
Saudi and Nelson we can't finish. Else is a scared baby to his whole deal plan. But I've actually got no credibility.
We will be pushing. So basically, all that we're doing is that the licensing requirements remain set by these industry-specific laws. If you're a bank, so you get a banking license, you get an insurance company, so you get an insurance license, and so on. So we're not changing any of the licensing systems. However, we are providing for, as we were talking about the other day, competition because...
I need to bring to that person and say, I'm looking at anything principle, so
what about yourself? Yeah, okay, I'm looking at then please do go.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, but remember, between you and your staff, yeah, we have to have somebody here all the time. It's really quite complex. So. And how are we going to manage it?
That's my responsibility.
Right. So you have to go, you have family and other issues, they understand.
Thank you.
Right. If there are legal issues that need, tomorrow is full staff here. So if there are legal issues, we'll table them. The fund is helping us, yeah? Right.
Mm-hmm.
Never mind that his house may get built down. Okay, alright. Who's taking notes here? We have to ask the executives to do it, right? Who's your note taker on your side? Okay, somebody take notes. So the other one. And email it to Alan, the committee secretary, and Peter Paul. Peter Paul, back at work. Yeah, but you and David are sitting here. You and David were agreeing. I'm saying, what about the book you feel you can't finish? Why doesn't it want to be? You can stand up. It's allowed. David is allowed to stand up. I know it's allowed. What do you think, James? Will you break your view? You should think the AC is just refused if you stand up. Let me complete. Wait, you can't finish. So please do it.
So we do allow those, for the things like proper communications, to have new licensing requirements, which means we need to look clauses. So basically all the clauses really apply to those. And also clauses apply to new licenses and renewals. We have this thing called dual key or two keys, which basically means when you apply for a new license, or you want to vary your existing license, you need to, both authorities need to agree if you're okay. But the authority that runs the whole process is the licensing authority, which is at Iceland.
What is the FPR bill giving the authority power to licensing?
Oh yes. So currently how it works for a bank is that almost all the powers link directly to the fact that it's licensed by the banking division department. Now however, the Financial Sector Conduct Authority will be able to have conduct standards which will explain to a bank how it's allowed to sell its products. There the powers come from the standards, not from the licensing requirements. So they didn't link the two.
No, this is quite complicated. I think we can rush it through. Go ahead, Charlie.
Are you currently on 111,
substitute 1, are we there? No, we can't do the contest right now. Can you finish this thing and we come back on this thing? Finish the slide, please.
Okay. We will, over the next 20, 30 years, we'll bring more pieces of legislation to... Phase 2 of Twin Peaks will continue, and then we will change the licensing framework as they go along. But many people, in the conversations over the last little while, most industry stakeholders believe we shouldn't change the licensing system at the moment. We completely agree with them. They have licenses, we're not going to make that more complicated for them.
Okay,
cool.
On the concept, anyone want to comment? Nope.
Close by clause. 111.1, we respectfully call this the mono clause, in the sense that you may not provide a license unless, you may not provide a financial service unless you are licensed to do so. But there are certain transitional provisions which we provide for. You cannot pretend that you have a license, and you may not permit another person to identify the person as licensed, and so forth. These are basically the clauses that, you know, when you go, when you have an advert on the radio and they say this person is a registered financial services provider.
Yeah.
Etc.
Anything on this clause? Colleagues? Yes, Andy?
Sir, you remember a few days ago I asked a question related to...
We remember everything, Jason.
Yes. I about, you know.
Yeah. In what you said in July last year.
So,
we can't remember what we did, but we remember everything you
did. I don't remember anything. That's the truth. Now, this clause actually is saying that headstones are coming, so for us to not provide. You know that when you don't have access.
Yes.
But they are doing that. Yeah, if I interested to provide.
So interesting, Shoprak, I think, has an NCR license and an FSC license for those.
You can't come, eh? Don't follow us.
Oh, you come back.
Blends of demand regulates all when it comes to the product set.
No.
So that's the big news for me.
They are kind of, so Faye says a few.
Yes, that's right. So I said the actual banking product, not the banking product. They're not, so they're going to fall under this new product.
Yes.
There are a number of conditional that provide, so if you're expecting the tax evasion, it's not just a whole kind of shutdown. It would be okay because we're going to be closing in, and we've got potentially a lot of cars to come back for it.
Most of this is already done by the FSC.
Yes.
Okay, the only, rather than the FSC, they've got a few more regulatory issues.
Yeah.
The only questions, and they'll be full capital electricity problems.
Right.
So, but the bank that they actually do is a cash bonus.
Yeah. Bank is bank, insurers, and the JSC.
From the regulatory country reporting and stuff like that.
Which they already have on time, but the JSC is still something. Are you recording?
Same
day. Different day. The
Okay, so it's not even active. We walk through.
literally the walls going to fall apart if we can't make them.
Yes, but
I think that this is the board note 18. Section. Currently, Borders AC doesn't have any of the speech requirements. Like an impact study. All the members. It's written specifically for Borders AC. Yes, before in the old days they were specifically.
But then we discovered that that's awkward. If we're so unhappy about the ones who start using a little more of because they said one person's version of the
We are actually regulated by the system for the system, and we've discovered that we don't have other people.
And they are, I mean,
requirements, the government and risk management, and whether or not the applicant made a statement that is false or misleading. I guess if the applicant makes a statement that is false or misleading, that would be very bad. When they determine the application, they must be sure that the applicant has sufficient resources and capacity to ensure they comply with the requirements of the law. So these are very straightforward, obvious things to think about. When a licensee gets a license, it must report to the regulator if it has contravened or is contravening a law, directive, enforceable undertaking, or a report or a decision of the tribunal. A license can't be transferred from the licensee to another person. 119, a license may be varied provided that you follow all the right checks and balances.
So we stop there.
Suspension, because that might be it. So all these forms, any questions, comments, Nobody? Ah, yes, go ahead.
When you say the license can't be transferred, so that includes sale of a shares, so a subsidiary being sold off from Standard Bank to FME.
They have to apply
for a new license. That's
a circumstance still.
Refers to Jan. There's a separate question in respect of significant owner. So significant owner needs to go through a process. If you're selling shares, you will go through that process. It's not there. The legal entity remains the same, it's just ownership there.
Good.
Next one, please. Against suspension of licenses.
So you can suspend license if the license is applied for suspension. Obviously, if a condition of the license has been contravened or not complied with, the licensee has, I think, just take a step back for a moment and say, why would we prefer suspension to cancellation? So, in general, the preference is that the regulator suspends license and doesn't cancel it, and you kind of give an opportunity to the licensee to correct his behavior. Even suspending a license is a very extreme thing to do. So, suspension has a lot of conditions related to it. I don't think we need to go through them in great detail. However, you may revoke the license, and that's obviously quite a serious issue. You may revoke the license if the licensee applies for revocation of license. You may also revoke the license for the same list of reasons that you may have suspended the license for. And may revoke license if the guy is no longer doing business that he was doing before. But you may refuse to revoke a license if you don't think it would be in the interest of financial customers, or if it would frustrate the objects of financial sector law. Then 122. You may allow a person whose license is suspended to carry on the business for a period of time. You don't necessarily want a company to stop operating immediately. You may want a sort of a period of transition. So then, 123 provides for the process that the responsible authority must follow for varying, suspending, or revoking a license. So firstly, you must give the licensee notice of the proposed action and a statement of reasons. Then you must invite the licensee to make submissions on the matter and to give them a reasonable period. That period is at least a month. Obviously, if there's a price, they need to do that. You must take into account all the submissions you made. You must make sure that there isn't a prejudice, as we discussed earlier, to the customers. And then after considering the submissions, you may then take the decision.
Alright,
any questions here, comments? Yeah. How long is the month? I'm going to ask Joanne to answer the question. Oh, me, how long is the month?
Well, that would be a calendar month.
Calendar month.
Yeah, that would be
a month,
such a calendar month.
These are just applications for licenses.
Yeah.
Did you call something?
the one that is just systemic for me.
That's in systemically important financial institutions.
Okay, 125, 126 onwards to 128.
So this is the zero key issue. So, issuing a license. So I'm reading 126 sub 2. Issuing a license, bearing license, suspending, revoking a license, and so forth. These things you have to get a concurrence of the other financial sector regulator to do them. So you can't grant a license without consulting your team and getting their concurrence. And then if it's a systemically important financial institution, you also need to get the concurrence of the Reserve Bank.
Right, any comments? Zafiva? No?
There is a new era in Kandy, so hopefully you see what I'm doing here.
Step 9.
That was for the... I haven't read the provision clearly, but does it prescribe any minimum period in which the authorities must respond to institutions requesting licenses or whatever the case may be?
Yeah, good point.
There is a clause on that, and I can't put my finger on where it is exactly, Kathy, but we will find it for you. We'll find it, it's there somewhere.
It's so we'll look at it for the system. I think in principle what it says is that you can apply for a period by which if it's taken, if the authority has not either approved or not approved the license, it's taken if they're not approved. And there have been concerns about acting in fairness for the financial institution involved. We took that approach because we think it actually, it provides for an action having been taken. So we've adopted that approach because in effect what that means is that that provides the financial institution with the, it empowers the financial institution to then take, regulate on review. If it's a case of you can extend it and extend it and extend it, in effect the financial institution could potentially be locked within the legal cycle and not actually have an action to secure them. We'll find it.
And I think, Caleb, this is an issue of property rights as well. Okay, and the thing is that's why I think 126 is quite important, because it does require concurrence. But that concurrence, it goes beyond just the two core regulators. Okay, but this is an issue, because, see, let me give you an example. You could have the NCR take away Standard Bank's credit license, okay? That will cause a systemic crisis. Clearly that needs to be covered, and that's the sort of test that you still need. I thought it was covered.
Is that important? Huh?
Okay, sorry?
No.
Okay.
So just on that point relating. So the dual key currently is specifically to the Commerce Department and the Prudential Authority. And the reason being is because all the powers and actions and responsibilities for those regulators are defined, and the licensing provisions are defined within the course of the Act. It starts getting more tricky when you bring in another regulator, which powers and functions are contained in a completely unrelated Act, given that the Credit Act currently is not provided with financial sector law. So it is something I think an interesting point we can further engage on, but that was the original thing.
Can I ask what you mean? The Credit Act is not regarded as a financial sector commission.
No, it's not
a financial sector law. So it is in context, it is, but in terms of this Act, it's not defined as a financial sector law. And the reason being for that is because by virtue of being a financial sector law, brings on a whole set of, again, powers and functioning responsibilities that it imposes on the regulators. And like, so for example, it gives the on-site visits and inspections and investigations. So if you were to define the Credit Act as a financial sector law and bring the credit regulator onto that, it would be completely duplicating and replicating.
Yeah, okay.
But change is an important point. Mm-hmm. So there's two issues here, okay? When it comes to credit, certainly the biggest 90% plus of the credit is from banks, okay? So in that sense, for us it would be a financial sector law. But there's also credit from furniture stores, etc., okay? Even if they borrow from a bank, but and that's the type that we wouldn't want to cover. The issue, of course, is that the harmonized system here does mean that your system of appeals, and as you get towards it later, you get your tribunals and so on, that we have a common one. At the moment, the NCR, I think, does it through the Consumer Protection Tribunal and so on. So certainly, I think that when you look at the FCEP, the issue is how does the regulator, when it comes to your financial institutions like banks, work within the twin court system? And that's the clarity that we need.
Okay, so move on. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. We're going to hedge our bet a little bit and move along to Chapter 14.
Why Chapter 14?
Because Kathy won't be here tomorrow, and she's the only one that understands Chapter 14. I would not like to answer these questions.
No, I think don't get knocked on by a bus. We're talking to Lou, we can't pass the bill, right?
No.
She understands it. Kathy, don't die, please.
I'll do my best.
Until we vote on the bill, then you're free to do so. I can see that.
I think I wrote that once
before. All right, guys, go for it. We're looking at slide 23. So number study surface, right?
So we're moving to chapter 14, which is the underpinning system. And what we are doing is moving towards a much more harmonized and integrated ombuds system. So currently, different ombuds for different sub-parts of the industry are provided for in different ways. We have statutory ombuds, for example, the phase ombuds and the pension fund adjudicator, which means these are ombuds provided for by statute, and the organizational structures are provided in statute, versus also industry ombuds, which are ombuds funded by industry. And even across the statutory ombuds and the voluntary ombuds, the way in which those ombuds function and are funded and operate and adjudicate on their decisions and their rights and obligations are all quite different depending on which ombuds you look at. Given the current financial system, which has become increasingly consolidated, as we've been discussing ad nauseum, what it means is that it's an incredibly complex and confusing structure for customers. So depending on what you're busy about, if you've got a problem or a concern with your product or service that has been provided, who do you complain to, how do you complain, what service can you expect, all of those things currently are theoretic and you get better or service provided for them know who your ombud is in the first place. There's additional complexity because of bundling of products. So say for example you have you take out a loan attached to which is credit insurance, and you may or may not have been given some recommendation about which loan or which credit insurance to take out. So there are various pieces of law which that attributes to. In that case, it's the Credit Act, depending on which insurance act, it will be the Insurance Act, and the Pays Act. And then it's easy for the customer to try and navigate who is it complaining to in which way, etc. So we are now moving towards a standardized system, and again, moving towards a system where the ombuds operate within a minimum level of their service and best practice. So the FSR Bill proposes to repeal the FSR Act, which is an existing ombuds law that provides fee in a hair-raising way all these different things that I've just been talking about, together with we're not repealing the statute on the statute, and I'll explain why. The FSR Bill then proposes establishing an Ombuds Regulatory Council as a statutory body which is going to impose requirements on each of these ombuds, which in effect will imply a minimum best practice that I'll be talking about. So if we say, for example, complaints, how do you manage your complaints process? How long do you have to respond to a complaint? what information do you need to provide to the regulator relating to complaints that have been heard? All these kinds of issues, we're wanting to develop common standards to be applied across all ombuds, irrespective of whether it's a statutory ombud or an industry ombud. So the example provides for this council and an effective strengthening of what the council is currently. What we have currently is a council which is intended to do these things, but those responsibilities are not defined very well and it has no powers with which to do it. In which case it has to go around negotiating with the various ombuds in terms of how it is that they're going to improve their service and their standards. That's obviously not as useful as it could be. So the council will then have the powers in order to set these minimum standards and enforce those standards. The chief ombuds is provided for the day-to-day management and administration of this council. We require that all ombudsmen will be registered in terms for under this council and will be subject to the standards imposed by the council. There are strengthening mechanisms for the council, in fact the council is required, its entire functioning is around the harmonisation and the standardisation of practice for ombuds. And the ombud council relating to these powers will be able to issue directives and forceful understandings. And I'm sorry, you'll get into much more detail what these things are. We've obviously skipped a few factors. But in effect, these are the various administrative actions that can be taken to support the enforcement and the like. Importantly, and I think this is something which we're going to need to provide a note to you on, and we might need a dedicated session on this down the line, is that this is seen as a stepping stone. What's provided for in the HR bill is there's been an enormous amount of discussion around which ombuds were best. Do industry ombuds work best? Which statutory ombuds work best? The version that we see now is, in fact, a stepping stone to accommodate, moving forward, this idea about having statutory ombuds and industry ombuds. It's difficult to accommodate both. And moving forward, we need to envisage a world where we either have just industry ombuds, which in effect would lead to a single ombud, which is the model of the UK, versus multiple industry ombuds and just having industry ombuds. The problem with having industry ombuds and only industry ombuds is that there are cases where products are provided that actually lie, there might be new types of products that lie outside of the scope of industry ombuds that are provided for and the like. So even then, you need a mechanism to provide for those kinds of products and services that lie outside of the scope of industry ombuds. So for example, payment services, and I'll use this example again, payment services that are offered by the bank or non-bank, in many cases those are not currently covered by even on the bank ombuds requirement, by the banking ombuds. Never mind payment services provided by a non-bank, so you've got various retailers you're getting involved in that space. There are currently no ombuds that deal with those kinds of issues.
I think just to get a broader context, if you look at market conduct, part of it is for the market conduct regulator to be checking with firms. We'd be checking on how do they deal with complaints, okay? Do they process it, etc. You want those things to be reported. Obviously, when a matter goes to an ombud, it means that the company's own internal complaints processes have failed, okay, for whatever reason, good or bad. You want to know in the first instance that the company has a proper process to deal with complaints, and you know, its policy is just not say no to all complaints, okay. It's got to consolidate and actually take steps. Then it goes to the ombud. Now, when Kathy raises the issue of statutory versus industry, when you have an industry one, and I think certainly the long-term insurance ombud works probably very well in this instance. It's a good example of a voluntary ombud, where the industry comes together and agrees that the rulings of the, because sometimes precedents are set and so on, but the rulings of the ombud will be actually adhered to. They won't take it to court. When you have a statutory ombud, what happens is people take the issue to court and they lose it.
Currently,
okay? And so there's pros and cons in these systems. And of course, then we'll get to the issue of tribunals as well in a moment. But it's not. But I think that it's an important part of the architecture. In a way, if too many things are coming to the ombud, you think there's a problem low down with the market conduct practices perhaps, and what are your first regulators doing, your core regulators doing. There needs to be better feedback mechanisms, which currently I don't think is the case.
All right.
But are we done with the conceptual thing? We'll let out the questions quickly. Can I ask, generally one would tend to go towards statutory ombuds because it's more likely to be objective and fair than industry ombuds. Is that because industry has vested interests as well? Am I correct or wrong in saying that?
Well, yes and no.
Yeah.
But the point is there's no buy-in from the industry, and then people resort to their rights in court. Okay. And these things can become very legalistic. Is it in the contract or not? Now, when we deal with market conduct, we want to even question whether the contract was fair to the customer in the first instance. So put that aside. But then it goes to ombuds. They're going to look at it sort of from a legalistic perspective. And it's also a case of people not being forced to use lawyers, and it's an easy system to and that these issues can be sorted out quickly.
Just quickly, and now that it comes in, most countries, what do? In this sort of Olympic style model, the institutory or industry?
So can I just say, on our industry one, aside from anything, it's too fragmented. So when Kathy says banking will deal with this, frankly, some of our ombuds, I think, are puppy ombuds, okay? Because there was a big fight when one ombud was, term of office was not renewed. Now, is that because the ombud was taking action against the industry? Because the funding also comes from the industry.
Yeah.
So certainly, on our funding arrangements, we want to make sure there's no direct funding, but through the levy, we will fund the ombuds, okay? So that no ombud needs to feel that I'm under the influence of the industry on one hand, and certainly the industry must feel that ombud is not a consumer activist, okay, and always going to rule against the industry. So it sort of needs that type of balance. So the scope is an issue at the moment. If you apply, you may not even know which ombud to apply to. And having a chief ombud in one office, and certainly the ombuds offices today have tried to consolidate. But look, here's the other thing that comes is, the credit ombud won't be part of this, okay? So, one's going to have to look at some of the practicalities that even if you don't affect the NCR, does it not make sense to merge some of these other problems that are related?
Okay.
We're done. Oh, Brandon, so.
Just a quick question. There's the pension fund adjudicator. What are the other...
Price ombud and the pensions fund adjudicator are the statutory ombuds. And then there's the banking ombud, there's a long-term insurance ombud, there's the short-term insurance ombud, and then it's SOS.
Maybe some other
company. Oh, JSC has one? The JSC has its own mechanism. And of course, when you there's the Tuli Madan Seratap ombud. So this is different from that. And similarly, there's a SARS ombud. Now, those are different, I'm saying. Okay, so we mustn't take the word and get confused, okay? And the mechanisms would be different, but certainly in the financial sector, because certainly when I sit in my job, I say, okay, there's an approach to the SARS ombud that's quite different to the financial ombud. And I think of necessity that will be the case, because SARS is the only tax collector, and it's not like there's companies and so on, and the person who's the ombud will really need to understand the processes itself. So it becomes a different set of issues to an industry type in a financial sector where you really do work by laws and contracts and so on.
Thank you.
Okay, so longer term, obviously you bring them into probably two big ombuds, one for the one authority and one for the other. You're going to save a lot of money, because there's probably a lot of duplication. At the moment, there's probably a lot of lease agreements and different expiry periods, etc. So, on a longer period, it's going to bring the cost down of this, or the ombud, if you can bring it to one big super ombud, right? There's probably specialist departments dealing with the different things. So that's probably the progress.
Yes, and to answer just a second other question, how does it affect this? Obviously, it varies so much. I mean, a few years ago, South Africa hosted the International Conference of Ombuds. So, whilst banking is developed, the market conduct side human misconduct with policies, it's not as developed. And if you ask about developing countries, basically, you know, the focus on the customer is not there. So this is almost the sort of, you know, future step, and the systems vary a lot.
Chief, anything else? No?
of Twin Peaks coming from an extremely rabid free market approach that says people have contracts and who are you to interfere? The big point about the regulatory side of market conduct is to say there's a big asymmetry of power between financial institutions and their customers. And you can't just leave it to the market and can't say, but the clause is right. The issue is, was the clause fair in the first place, okay? And that's how you get to the policy protection rules and the kind of overriding some of those contexts. And one's talking about retail customers here. So there's a lot of depth in this. There are people who from an ideological perspective will be completely against all of these interventions. But what we want to do is to find quick solutions and processes that take, you know, that are quick, that don't take a year or so. Otherwise, you might as well go to court because, and of course for that you need money and all of that, so people will just not follow through. So I think the issues you raise are certainly the kind of issues that we think are very important.
Okay. So we want a If you look at this objective, it looks like the omnibus will only cover the financial sector conduct for it. Because it's only for the financial system of customs. So probably not going to, at this stage, cover a dispute with the prudential authorities to issue a license or not. So and that was one of the comments I saw in the complaints is that the regulator issues the license and then interprets the terms of that license. So maybe something to consider on the reason not to is if it will be extended the scope of omnibus, but also include an omnibus between the bank or instance an insurer applicant and
the way I understand it, omnibus is something between a customer and the institution. If you have a problem that your license has not been approved, then it's a tribunal, am I right? So you want to complain to the, let's say the staff hasn't given you your prudential license, is that what you're talking about?
This is an idea.
Yes. Then we'll go to the tribunal, right?
Yeah. There are a number of different things that we covered, and just I'll respond to some first. There's a distinction between the relationship between a financial institution and a customer, or we distinguish between, and a financial institution as a customer of the regulator, if we see it like that. And the omnibus is intended as a quick and easy and cheap dispute resolution process for financial customers, given the heavy asymmetry of power between financial institutions and customers. So it's a cheap and easy way to access fairness. Which is not to say that there shouldn't be fair availability of justice for the financial institutions as well, and that's provided for in terms of the tribunal mechanism, which we will then speak more on. Of course, in listening to you say this, there is a question about smaller institutions, and I think we need to be particularly mindful ensuring that access to the tribunal is as streamlined and cost-effective as possible as well. In terms of the major approach in 20 jurisdictions, primarily they're moving to a single omnibus model, so it would be a statutory omnibus, so it's established in terms of the law, and it would be a system-wide omnibus. So it would, that omnibus is responsible for the financial system as a whole, by which it would set up panels and expertise underneath it. Having said that, the South African experience has, as I said, been mixed. So we can't just, you know, ideologically, yes, go the statutory omnibus. The natural fact, when the industry ombudsmen that are working well, they're actually working best and are most cost effective. Because remember, ultimately these things have to be funded somewhere. And if the statutory ombudsman comes through really. So it's not to say that it's ideologically, and our sentiment at the moment is that a chief ombuds statutory is probably best, but we need to make sure that actually that's practical from a South African perspective. And that's exactly the case which we'll be exploring going forward. In terms of being two ombuds, actually it's probably not so much a prudential ombud and a conduct ombud. It would actually be a single ombud. I need to put industry ombud, in which case it would be banking, insurance, etc. In the case of where you've got industry ombuds, I think if that's the model we end up going, you need much greater flexibility in terms of how the ombuds can actually work together and actually, you know, potentially even make decisions together relating to bundled products. On the statutory ombud, the switching around, well, the financial institution can take the statutory ombuds to the court, that's just because of the way that the current law is structured. Actually, in the UK, that's, you can't. So, you know, we can legislate for anything. It's not to say that the ombud can't be held accountable, but we go through the usual review mechanisms as the regulator. So, exactly, and you can limit, the point is that depending on what you perceive being the best outcome, that's how we can pass the policy and the law around that. And then for all the issues that need to be explored. In terms of how they're to resolve, exactly that's what this intended to do. So apparently the ombudsman can't fix standards. In the new world, they can't fix standards. And those need to be complied with. So that would be looking at section 199, so we'll get to that. Can I move through onto the So moving then onto the clauses, 173 that establishes the ombud council, 174 then talks to the objective of the council, which is the ensuring that financial customers have access to able to use affordable, effective and independent resolution processes. 175 then describes the functions. And these funds are, as we've been talking around, consolidation, standardizing, imposing minimum standards, delivering best practice by the ombuds. It's not only about best practice by the ombuds, it's also increasing awareness about the ombuds and the role that they serve. And I think we probably need to be much more creative about that going forward, even if an ombuds is continuing. I think obviously we're going to need more creativity in deciding how these things are named, branded and marketed and the like. Can I presume that there will be questions?
No, let's just go over this thing. Objective and functions, any comments?
Nope, right.
Section 176 through to... And the number of things. All the way through. Okay, there are a lot of clauses that basically deal with. In fact, the rest of the part deals with governance of the Ombuds Regulatory Council, and you are largely replicating the governance clauses that you would have seen in both the Prudential Authority and the Conduct Authority. In effect, it provides that the council is, if we look at 177, it establishes the board of the Ombuds Council, made up of the Commissioner, Chief Ombuds, and 4 to 6 of the members. Importantly, there's a minister that appoints the board. The terms of office of the board members are then described in section 179, the service conditions in section 180, removal in 181, the role of the board in 182, which are important, so I'll highlight, to generally oversee the management and administration of the Ombuds Regulatory Council. The reason why we've gone for a board model here, which we previously said, for example, in the Conduct Authority commission structure, is that we wanted to streamline this as much as possible, both the ombuds, the executive versus the non-executive. So the commission structure is made up of a commission plus 2 to 4 auto-executive members. Here we legislated only for one full-time person, which in effect is the chief ombuds. And then the board can be made up of a non-executive function. So it's a narrower, more streamlined role with fast
still
given.
Would it be a full-time role?
Would
it be a full-time role or part-time?
They are always the board, but the obligations would be part-time.
What I mean is they're not permanent appointments.
No. No, they're not. They are permanent appointed, but not
full-time.
Yes.
Okay, why do you
think it's easier? Sorry?
It's
easy. 183. 183 describes how meetings of the board.
That's really banal.
184 is that. So all of these are just more. What is important for section 186, and this describes the role of the chief ombuds. And just a bit again, this is governance, the performance, and just saying that the chief ombuds is accountable to.
So duty is delegation, staff and resources, duty is staff, disclosure of interest for attendance.
All the standards.
Let's go to part two.
Part two. Now this is, these are the crucial causes which come out of the after HIV and the improvements. And what the what this part provides for is how industry ombuds are to be recognised. The 192 for the application, 193 requirements. These are all just more procedural issues: the requirement for further information, the determination of applications. One, if we look at 194.2, this is more of an important, when I say important, it's technically, so the Ombuds Regulatory Council must not recognise the industry ombuds scheme unless it is satisfied, and then there are a number of criteria that we would need to gauge the recognition of an industry ombuds again. A deals with making sure there's not industry fragmentation. In other words, it's got a significant number of the financial institutions involved or with that ombuds. And it's very important to be the governing rules of the industry on the scheme. And I think this is also where it gets to the standardization, the question of standardization and harmonization and minimum and the minimum standards. Because these really are the rules that govern how the scheme is going to be operated. So we'll talk to identifying the products that are within the scheme, how do you make an adequate provision for compliance, that the scheme must be legally binding on its members, all these things which should be improved for an industry scheme to function. Then section 195, 196, 197, 198 all goes to the varying goals, the vocation, etc. Of those approvals. So I'm going on to part three unless there are questions. Part three then deals with the powers of the Regulatory Council, the Ombuds Regulatory Council, and it talks to the making of rules and it goes to the requirements that can check for the industry or the statutory ombuds. So 199 subsection 2. These are the parameters: governing rules, governance, the qualification and experience of ombuds, the definition and types of complaints to be dealt with by the specified ombuds. Just highlighting that one of the issues that's been of concern, or that has eroded the effective functioning of the ombuds, is who determines which case when, and how those complicated, those more how those lines are dealt with between ombuds. We've also seen cases where industry knowing that one ombuds more lenient than another ombuds extends the scope of the industry ombuds capacity to, in order to make sure that it has jurisdiction and in effect ensuring also it has greater leniency by effect. So there are a number of manipulations that happen and these again are matters which need to be better resolved in IMO. Then the remainder of that section puts to the rule being consistent with financial sector laws, can't interfere with the independence of an ombuds, then going to independence, Then the other part, besides the rulemaking powers, section 200, 201, 202, 203, all the way on to the rest of part 3, deals with the general administrative action type powers. So it's directives, enforceable undertakings. We haven't covered this, but just to highlight, an enforceable undertaking is where the ombuds council, in this instance, could get the ombuds scheme to commit to a certain practice. So it hasn't implemented it's not a directive, it hasn't instructed it, it's not an order, it hasn't assigned a penalty. All it's doing is it's another tool in its supervisory armory to get the ombuds scheme to behave in a certain way. And often this is very useful. It's a slightly softer tone and it's often very effective. But it'll be more disgusting what it takes through the initial action plan. The other initial penalties, pressure information, on site, etc. I think those are very specific penalties.
Anything, any questions on part three? Well, can I suggest something? This is quite an important
chapter. Are you speaking to it quite fast? So the members will have to mull them. They're not, by the fact, asking questions. So they're not asking questions, implying, you know, that we have people here. I also need to alert certain majority parties that people are clearly at ease and we're not conducting. So we have to round up here and we will have to continue tomorrow. I was thinking, that's a good point.
Unfortunately, we all actually have to eat to enter the airport.
Right now.
Yeah, we have it wrong.
Why
well,
is it just the whole chicken?
You have to finish.
Yeah.
But you can go. Don't look at your flight.
No,
I mean,
I can't.
Oh, I told you you've got to go. Quickly.
Control the
pain. Okay, right.
No, we're all trying to
evacuate
since we've
overnight,
but there's no
accommodation. And then also for tomorrow, Roy's not the only person who can actually stay.
Well, if you want to come quickly, then you've got to deliver.
Yeah.
Let me just...
No, we've had to find a couple.
Yeah, we understand. Your whole army, you didn't know it was such a big army. And such many different units. Go ahead, please. Can you
sure.
Just Okay.
Yes. Part four being
general. But I just want to ask you, Mr. Luke, and Mr. McCarthy, right? Let's see what public hearing is with you. And then we then ask you to draw the conclusion. What else
So I think they are sort of particularly on restrictions on this part. They are it might be under general, but they are particularly important clauses. Like section 207 talks about the council needing to establish and operate a centre to facilitate customers' access to appropriate ombuds.
Yeah.
So there are additional measures that these provisions introduce or implement to give better effect to the system and how it functions.
Good.
Okay. Are there any questions here? No. Thank you all. I'll take members and department and officials here. One for the Holland and patients. Yeah, but actually when we dealt with the registration on local government, actually set from 9 in the morning till about 2 to 4 in the morning, so we did that. Similarly with other legislation like property rights law. So I think by the time what Parliament did, that's just a chance to sit like that as well. Okay, fine. We're not going to do this very often. We're done for now. We need to get, instead of 2, something else happens, we meet at 3 tomorrow. When the House starts, we meet, and we'll leave before the House budgets, and we must meet tomorrow, come on. Even if there's a public hearing Friday, please. Thank you all. Can the accommodations remain behind, please? And can the rest of you go quick, 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 quick?